yo, check this out, man.
We're people gonna rise up, take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution.
This week in radical history, for the week starting September 1st. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer. Radical info was found at the Daily Bleed website, and some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York.
There is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes.
This week in radical history, for September 1st, 1921, the Battle of Blair Mountain was the largest organized armed uprising in America labor history and led directly to the labor laws currently in effect in the United States of America. In a traditional fashion, President Harding would order federal troops in, and they would drop bombs from planes to end the strike. Also on September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland, start of World War II. To quote Hermann Hesse, "Of course the soldiers who die in the war are worthy our deepest sympathy. Many of them did great things and suffered greatly, and in the end they paid with their lives. But that does not make them heroes. The common soldier, at whom an officer bellows as he would a dog, is not suddenly transformed into a hero by a bullet that kills him. To suppose that there can be millions of heroes is, of course, itself an absurdity. The obedient, well-behaved citizen who does his or her duty is not a hero. Only an individual who has fashioned his or her self-will, their noble, natural inner law, into their destiny can be a hero." Hermann Hesse. Lastly, for September 1st, 1987, protesting American arms shipments to the Contras by blocking military trains, San Francisco activist S. Brian Wilson loses both legs below the knees when the train fails to stop. Now that's a hero.
Monsieur R, Oria, Mr. Funky, Kiki Aragon, l'International, 2006.
This week in radical history, for September 2nd, 1872, the Hague Congress of the First International is held. It is here that Marx and Engels determined it is better to kill the International than allow the growing anti-authoritarian influence to gain control. Under the thumb of Karl Marx, the Congress confirms the principal resolution of the London Conference and takes to task the anarchists and their, quote, divisive, unquote, activities, i.e. anti-authoritarian activities. It expelled the representatives, including Mikhail Bakunin, from the International on the South. Items for September 2nd, 1981, UN Human Rights Commission rules that Canadian Indian Act violates international human rights. The problem of the First Nation tribes in Canada and the gross violation of human rights and treaties throughout Canada fight on to this day. Also in 1993, San Francisco mayor starts arresting Food Not Bombs volunteers. Their crime, feeding the homeless. This week in radical history for September 3rd, 1860, William Walker, a U.S. citizen who once set himself up as dictator of Nicaragua, invades Honduras with his own private army. Once he arrives, he reestablishes slavery. Also on September 3, 1897, Emma Goldman begins lecture tour in Providence, Rhode Island, and speaks at two open-air meetings attended by thousands. The then mayor warns Goldman that she'll be arrested if she speaks at open-air meeting again. Despite the prohibition, Emma continues to lecture. Speaking of Red Emma, 12 years later in 1909, the mayor of Burlington, Vermont, prevents Emma Goldman from speaking anywhere in his city. Accompanied by Ben Reitman, Emma is attempting to exercise her supposed free speech rights in a short lecture tour in Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, and is harassed nonstop everywhere she goes. Also on September 3, 1915, Australia, Wobbly Tom Barker is arrested for his anti-war poster. Quote, "Workers, follow your masters, stay at home," unquote. Anti-recruiting efforts finally get him 12 months of hard labor, but he quickly released within 3 months following a series of fires in stores and factories. No cause and effect there at all. Also on this date in 1954, the Espionage and Sabotage Act authorizes the death penalty for peacetime sabotage. Also, Congress passes a bill to revoke the citizenships of persons convicted of conspiracy to overthrow the government. These laws that are so loosely worded that governmental abuse of this law abounds. Also on September 3, 1974, former Nixon attorney John Dean enters prisons for the Watergate crimes. Now he's a criminal attorney, proving once again that once you're in the team, you'll do fine, like criminals such as Ollie North or war criminal Henry Kissinger. Do the crime and you'll do just fine. Also on this date in 1991, 25 workers die in a fire at the Imperial Food Processing Plant, Hamlet, North Carolina. 19 were single mothers. A non-union plant, it had not been inspected by the federal or state agencies for 11 years. Despite 3 minor fires earlier in the year and other obvious dangers, the fire exits remained locked. One of the worst disasters of its kind, reminiscent of the Triangle Garment Factory fire in the early 1900s. Also on this date in 2001, South Africa, U.S. and Israel walk out of U.N. conference on racism. Of course they would. Lastly, for September 3, 2003, thousands log on to blow up a virtual bush. This online game, pitting defecating peace doves, the player, against American President George W. Bush, is attracting thousands of play a day, including American government departments. Launched last week by the South African student website Get a Life. Quote, "We're able to monitor where the hits are coming from," says Andy Hadfield of Get a Life. He adds, "The game is very popular in Germany, England, South Africa, and France. You win when Bush explodes into a nuclear mushroom, or lose when Rumsfeld's missiles hit your pooping doves once too often."
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 4th, in 1781, a group of 46 settlers founded the city of Los Angeles, 12 years after the Spanish began their conquest and occupation of California. 40 years later, Mexico took control of the city after having gained their independence from Spain, 25 years after it was snatched up by the United States in their quest for manifest destiny. The American city of Los Angeles later became the setting for events such as the exclusion and internment of Japanese American citizens, the Watts riots, the mass criminalization of people of color, intense gang violence, and the destructive crack epidemic. I wonder how things might have been had Spain and Europe stayed on their side of the Atlantic. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
This week in Radical History for September 4th, 1886, legendary Apache surrenders to General Nelson Miles at Skeleton Canyon, Arizona, ending the last major U.S.-Indian conflict. Geronimo led a small band of men, women, and children out of a forced internment camp on the San Carlos Reservation, successfully evading thousands of U.S. and Mexican troops over the next 18 months in the Southwest Wilderness. Also on September 4, 1903, Cripple Creek, Colorado, where mine owners are trying to bust a labor union, as police and deputy sheriffs are relieved their duties and all citizens are required to register their firearms, as Governor Peabody sends in the militia. Then in 1904, they seize a local sympathetic newspaper and round up strikers into bullpens and take them to the Kansas border and abandon them. General Sherman Bell of the Colorado National Guard shouted, "Habeas corpus, hell, we'll give them postmortems." This week in Radical History for September 5th, 1877, Great Sioux warrior Crazy Horse is murdered. Crazy Horse and his starving people had peacefully surrendered to U.S. Army on May 6th. Crazy Horse was assassinated on orders of a local reservation agent, bayoneted in the back by U.S. soldiers while in custody at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. Also on September 5, 1882, First American Labor Day observed, 30,000 workers march in parade sponsored by the New York City Central Labor Union. Also on that date in 1911, pupils desert the classroom and parade in the streets after a Lily boy is punished for passing around a note urging his friends to strike against corporal punishment. In the next fortnight, schools in over 60 major towns and cities will come out in solidarity.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
Also on that date in 1917, the Palmer Raids begin. Federal agents attack Industrial Workers of the World, IWW halls and offices in 48 cities across the nation. Federal agents conduct coordinated raids, seizing records, destroying equipment and books, arresting hundreds of wobbly activists for the crime of labor organizing and, quote, obstructing, unquote, World War I. This is done without warrants and with total disregard for civil liberties and legal rights. In December of 1919, the Palmer agents gathered 249 people of Russian origin, including well-known radical leaders such as Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, and placed them on a ship bound for the Soviet Union. During one of the raids, more than 4,000 individuals were rounded up in a single night. All foreign aliens caught were deported, with no requirement that there be any evidence against them under the provision of the Anarchist Act. All in all, by January of 1920, Palmer and Hoover had organized the largest mass arrest in U.S. history, rounding up at least 10,000 individuals. Two more items for September 5th, 1989. George Bush I announces a $7.9 billion anti-drug plan. George uses a bag of crack purchased across the street from the White House as a prop to show how ubiquitous drugs are. Later, it was revealed that a DEA agent had to lure a drug dealer there. Why he didn't score the crack from his drug-using son, George II, is unknown. Lastly, for September 5th, 2005, Common Ground Collective offers solidarity, not charity, to survivors of the Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. They are the first and for a long time the only aid group in the devastated New Orleans area and harassed by cops for weeks.
I went down to New Orleans with some residents and activists of that devastated area. I plugged into the Common Ground Collective.
Of all the problems of racism and classism that were existing down here before, what happened down here was whole series of human rights violations against people of the Gulf Coast perpetrated by the city, state, and federal governments in conjunction with many national and international-based relief organizations.
That lack of organization from the government and what they're kind of where they're falling through, what you've seen where they fall through at?
Well, from what I've seen, it seems to be very bureaucratic in terms of getting supplies to any of the relief centers. You have to bear to prove your ID of residency. You need to prove that you're from the area, and most people lost most of the paperwork since Katrina and Rita had hit. Go to a federally run relief center, your chances of getting supplies are next to nothing.
It's a class war that's being waged down here. Folks around the country have to remember that just because, you know, CNN or Fox News is saying, oh, all services are 100% open down here, that's a crock of shit. And it's a matter of blatant lies being perpetrated against the people of New Orleans saying, oh, they're all hunky-dory now with their whole neighborhoods that don't have power, that don't have water.
Between the military checkpoints and the curfews that would change on a whim of the authorities, the curfews, you'd get a different answer whoever you asked, because there were no military. There were no police here in some places for the first 3, 6 to 8 days. There was none of that presence on the ground. And then as soon as the military was here, they were acting like the checkpoints were necessary to keep out looters. I was like, you missed the boat. You're too late. You're lying. You're hypocritical. You're just wrong.
It's really important that people get down here if they can. I mean, this is a place where people are needed. I know that the Red Cross and FEMA are saying they don't need more bodies. And the reason that they're saying that is because they don't want people coming down here. They don't want people to know what they're doing. They don't want people to see the atrocities that are being committed every day. They don't want people to see the damage. They don't want people to really realize the war that's being waged right now, the war for New Orleans that's being fought.
Had been intimidated to force to give over her key, and her and her 4 children were out on the street, and she was crying. We can't get in contact with that woman. We wish we could. So here we've got these landlords that are going around the law, bullying, intimidating, bluffing people out. Construction crews over here, contractors, all these things. And they're telling 75-year-old women that they might get hit by trucks. It's just, you know, veiled threats. And
around here, I look at an apartment. They say $1,000 for deposit, $1,000 for rent. I am a personal clean house. The people not come back yet. I don't have enough money for pay that apartment's very expensive for me. I don't have place to go.
The need is still here, even in Algiers, where a lot of the community businesses aren't open, and it's 100 times fold that in huge swaths of this town, like in the 9th Ward, where almost nobody's back because there's no infrastructure set up there. So thanks again for all your efforts, and Common Ground's an awesome place, and I hope people get a chance to come down and check it out. And
this is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, September 6th, In 1876, race riots erupted in Charleston, South Carolina after a hostile encounter between two opposing political parties. This occurred toward the end of the Reconstruction era when many black citizens were intensely frustrated by the government's failed attempts at racial equality. That night, in Charleston, a crowd of progressive black organizations armed themselves and confronted a group of black conservative politicians who they felt betrayed their race. When a number of whites attempted to interfere and side with the black conservatives, the crowd grew angry and set out on a two-day rampage, assaulting white people in the streets, resulting in the death of one white man. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on September 6, 1901, President William McKinley, shot by professed anarchist Leon Chasgoods, police claimed that Chasgoods was inspired by one of Emma Goldman's lectures, and she is arrested in Chicago a few days later. Eventually, the case against her was dropped. Also on September 6, 1963, four little black girls killed in Birmingham, Alabama. A racist white supremacist church bombing in which defendants finally came to trial in May 2000, 37 years later. This week in Radical History for September 7, 1972, White House tapes reveal President Nixon went the extra, quote, legal mile, unquote, to get dirt to ruin Senator Edward Kennedy, who Dick considered a future contender for president. Today, Nixon tells the aides to play spies amongst the Secret Service detail assigned to protect Kennedy. Quote, plant one, plant two guys on him, Nixon said. That would be very useful, and he remarked ecstatically, quote, we might get lucky and catch the son of a beep, ruin him for 76. It's going to be fun. That's your president's for you. On this date in 1977, in Wisconsin's first judicial recall election, outraged Dade County citizens vote Judge Archie Simonson from office. Simonson called rape a normal male rejection of provoking female attire in modern society's permissive attitude towards sex, which is why he said he sentenced a 15-year-old to just 1 year probation for raping a 16-year-old. More sexual assaults occurred on September 7, 1991. Navy pilots sexually assault dozens of women at Tailhook Convention in Nevada. To this day, it is reported that 25 to 40% of all women entering the military will be sexually assaulted before leaving the service. Also on September 7, 1998, right-wing religious zealots firebombed two abortion clinics in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Despite the long and recent history of killing of abortion doctors and supporters, the FBI will have four times as many agents looking into Earth Liberation and animal liberation organizations than the doctors that are being killed. To this date, no ELF or ALF activities have ever killed anyone, though they label them as domestic terrorists. Lastly, in 2002, UN Human Rights Chief Mary Robinson accused the U.S., Russia, and China of hiding behind the war on terrorism to trample civil rights.
Stand up, all victims of oppression, for the tyrants fear your might. Don't cling so hard to your possessions, for you have nothing. Have no rights. Let race, this ignorance be...
That was Billy Bragg's Internationale, and this has been This Week in Radical History, produced out of the Gleekly Studios.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. With the nonsense that Palestinians are a minority in Israel, you cannot argue that the Palestinians aren't an integral part of Greater Israel, occupied and dispossessed, but integral. So argues journalist Gideon Levy in the August 25th edition of the Israeli newspaper Arez. We begin this week with the full text of Levy's article, which continues, and I quote, "A delusion under which most Israelis live lets them invent vacuous excuses based on the virtual reality they built for themselves. According to this fallacy, the state of Israel only controls its own citizens, most of them Jewish, of course, but nobody counts the millions of other subjects who fall under its control, at least as much, maybe more. They're invisible. That's the only way one can argue comfortably and learnedly about whether Israel is a Jewish and democratic state. The discussion is a fascinating intellectual one, with only one problem. It has long since lost its relevance. A country where about half the subjects are not Jewish can't be Jewish. If it insists on being Jewish by force, it isn't democratic. A state where half the subjects are denied rights can't be democratic. In a state that doesn't intend to change its borders or the nature of its rule, this discussion is merely part of the delusion of perpetually parading around naked, but feeling fully clothed. Two peoples equal in size live under Israeli rule. About 6.3 million Jews and 6.3 million Arabs. Half and half. That's the outcome of 50 years of life in the binational state, not Jewish and not democratic. To the 1.8 million Arab citizens, you have to add the 2.7 million Palestinians living under direct Israeli rule in the West Bank, and about 1.8 million living under indirect Israeli rule in Gaza. The fate of all these subjects, from registration at birth to the currency they use and most of their rights, is set in Israel. They are subject to its rule. They are part of the state. Israel tries to shake off its Palestinian subjects when it finds it convenient. At night it invades their homes, and by day it claims they aren't under its control. But you can't have it both ways. You can't argue that the Palestinians aren't an integral part of Greater Israel, occupied and dispossessed, but integral. The fact that this reality was forced on them by the military and that they aren't part of Israel's partial democracy doesn't mean they don't belong. The Jewish settlers in the West Bank are part of Israel, and their Palestinian neighbors aren't. That can't be, even if most of Israel's Jews prefer it. In a piece this month in Aretz's Hebrew edition, when Gadi Taub applauds Jewish democratic Israel, he bases his argument on the Arabs being a minority and the enlightened state treating them based on the EU Treaty for Protecting Minorities. It sounds lovely, but it's completely unreal. Minorities? Finland's 5.5% Swedish minority, Muslims in France, and Australia's 450,000 Aborigines are minorities. But half the population isn't a minority. The Arabs are only a minority based on false presentations, ignoring the existence of most of them. Just as Israeli TV viewing habits are only measured in Jewish households because that's convenient for the Jews, Taub only counts a small part of the minority because it's convenient for him. The Palestinians aren't minority. They're half the population. They're not migrants. They're locals. In Aretz's Hebrew edition earlier this month, Zvia Greenfield counts them as Taub does, and therefore can sing her praises of Jewish democracy. But Ronnie Shockin, in his piece, lifts the veneer that covers the state's contents, which are not Jewish and not democratic. As the era of the two-state solution draws to a close, and on the eve of the debate's diversion to the real issue, rights in the binational state that has been in existence for some time, it's time to stop talking about the Palestinians as a minority. Anyone who wants them to be a minority should have withdrawn from the West Bank long ago. But anyone who wants to keep the West Bank should withdraw from talking about a Jewish majority. There's no way around that, not even with the help of 1,000 articles discussing the wonders of this delusion of Jewish democracy. That was an article written by Gideon Levy in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. This week's feature presentation is an address that Israeli historian and author Ilan Pape gave to the Palestinian support organization, the Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, in Berkeley, California. MECCA is an amazing organization that does critical work all through the West Bank and Gaza in support of meeting the needs of children who live under occupation. Here is Ilan Pape speaking in Berkeley, California.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. And it's a great honor to be a keynote speaker in an event on behalf of MECCA. I was introduced to MECCA many years ago when one of my sons told me that there is a bus that came to visit us. The bus was Barbara Lubin with quite a few people in it. I thought he was joking, but there was a bus, and they all entered our house. And you probably remember that. And since then, I followed very closely what MECCA is doing, and it's a great honor to be part of the big family of MECCA and to support this sacred work. And I'm really humbled that I was chosen this year to be the keynote speaker. I also want to thank Mona for this very moving introduction. It's always rewarding to hear Palestinians refer to the ethnic cleansing as an affirmation of their own trials and tribulation in a way that I think also opens some hope for the future. Tonight's title comes under the headline of Palestine is still the issue. When I say that Palestine is still the issue, I don't mean that for anyone who sits in this hall, or for me, Palestine ever ceased to be the issue. I'm sure for all of us, every day, every time we do something on behalf of Palestine, we don't have to be lectured in any way or persuaded that Palestine is still the issue. Every day brings with it a different image that reminds us that Palestine is still the issue. The most recent image I'm taking with me everywhere I go is the photograph of 12-year-old Dima, who spent 75 days in Israeli jail. The day she was released, the desperation on her parents' face in the face of a ruthless ruler who can do whatever he wants with their children, and the very naive and really breaking, heartbreaking words of Dima, who said, "All I want to do is go back to my friends in school." So we don't need to be reminded that Palestine is still the issue. But I think you understand that the context of this talk is different. A lot of people would tell us that given what's going on in Syria, in Iraq, given the magnitude of the refugee issue in Europe, the economic problems in the United States, Palestine has been marginalized as an issue of global attention, as regional attention, and you cannot galvanize any more people to see Palestine as a central issue of humanity and inhumanity. And I think it is important to remind ourselves why Palestine, in this respect, despite all the horrific things that are happening in Syria and Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, and despite the problems facing refugees in Europe and here as well, despite all of these destruction, if you want, it is important to remind ourselves that Palestine is the issue, because much of what we see in the Middle East and outside the Middle East is connected to what happened in the past in Palestine and what happens today in Palestine. So in this respect, if you are still committed to Palestine with all your heart, if most of your activity is on behalf of the Palestinians and for the Palestinians, you are also acting on behalf of everyone else who nowadays suffers in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East from inhumanity and crimes against humanity. Palestine is the issue for five major reasons, and I would like to point out each one of them with a short introduction. Palestine is still the issue today because morally it is the last and only remaining struggle of indigenous native people against settler colonialism that is still very active. Palestine is not the only country where settler colonialism was visited upon. This very country we are in was one of the first projects of settler colonialism. Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. But in all these other countries where settler colonialism was definitely prevalent in the past, at least processes of change and transformation were taking place. Palestine is the only active remaining act of settler colonialism, and therefore it is representing the struggle of indigenous people and native people all around the world. Settler colonialism, as you may know, is the movement of desperate Europeans outside of Europe because they were persecuted there, because they felt that Europe was unsafe. And they went to other countries, to other continents. And when they arrived in those new places, they found an indigenous native population. Because they were persecuted, because they were looking for one-way ticket out of Europe, they felt that they don't only want to make the new country a home, but also to make it a homeland. The obstacle in the way of making a new place, a homeland, were always the indigenous native people. In many cases, the result of this clash between the wish to create a new homeland and the fact that someone else already lived there for centuries was genocide, elimination of the native people. We have to remind ourselves and remain hopeful that Palestine is still the issue because people were not genocided there. Because there in Palestine, the logic of elimination that informed settler colonialism in this country was terrible enough, but was not genocide. People were expelled. Villages were destroyed. The country was de-Arabized and Judaized. But the struggle continues because the people are still there. Because not all the country has been de-Arabized, and because the people themselves have not lost the struggle and the wish to go back to their homeland, and those who are in their homeland have not lost the aspiration to make it once more their beloved homeland. So this is a struggle that brings together the evils of settler colonialism in the past with the evil of colonialism in the present. And in this respect, if we want to be part of a better world that understands that European settlers wreaked havoc, genocide, apartheid, ethnic cleansing all around the rest of the world, it is in Palestine where we can still rectify some of that evil by showing that there is a way towards reconciliation, as was done at least partly in post-apartheid South Africa. So morally, Palestine is the place where the logic of elimination is still at work daily against the Palestinian people, and everyone who experienced it here in the past or still thinks about it can see in Palestine a place where this logic should be tackled, rejected, and replaced by humanization. Settler colonialism is also a human project that was motivated by dehumanization. People who were chased out of Europe and arrived in a place where someone else lived were usually poor people, persecuted people, victims of ethnic cleansing themselves. And in order to justify their transformation into victimizers themselves, they had to dehumanize the native people. They had to dehumanize the indigenous people. Zionism in Palestine is this lethal fusion of these two logics that still operates in 2016, where Palestinians are dehumanized and therefore are an object of elimination. Elimination is not always physical genocide. You can be eliminated by being enclaved and besieged in your own village without the right to move. You can be eliminated by being expelled within your own homeland to another place. You can be eliminated by being robbed of all your civil rights, either to vote or to be elected in a way that can have an impact on your own future. So in this respect, we are witnessing daily the experiment of settler colonialism in Palestine, motivated by these two logics of dehumanization and elimination. And if we are against such inhumanity, then Palestine should be the issue for us. Palestine is also the issue because it has been connected and associated in the most wrong way possible with anti-Semitism. For so many years, we were led to believe that the colonization of Palestine was the antidote to anti-Semitism. Europe, the United States, and the West in general used to convince themselves and others that because there was a problem of anti-Semitism, and its worst chapter was in Europe during the Holocaust, the only way to solve the hatred towards Jews because they are Jews was to allow them to colonize Palestine and dispossess the Palestinians. This irrational, this cruel logic that is at the heart of the connection between Zionism and anti-Semitism still fuels most of the support Israel gets in this country, and still is the main ammunition pro-Israeli groups and individuals use in this country to silence any criticism on the Jewish state and its criminal policies. And therefore, Palestine, and that's the second reason that Palestine is still the issue, because the Jewish problem of Europe, the Jewish problem of the West, is a universal problem. It was not only the problem of the Jews. The genocide of the Jews in the Second World War showed the cruelty of modernity, of European enlightenment, of the aspiration of Europeans to be culturally, morally, and politically superior to any other civilization. We need a closure to that terrible chapter in the history of humanity. Allowing Jews to colonize Palestine and dispossess the Palestinian is not the answer for this problem. I don't think today there's much anti-Semitism in the world anyway. But we need to make sure that people have a different conversation about the connection between anti-Semitism and Zionism and Palestine. The Zionization of Palestine increased anti-Semitism, did not lead to its disappearance. A democratic, free Palestine for all is the best antidote to anti-Semitism. And we have to talk to our Jewish friends. And we have to be honest with our Jewish friends that, and some of them are good friends of ours, who still believe that Israel for some reason is this insurance company that would be waiting for them should the Holocaust appear again in this country or elsewhere. We have to explain to them that this is not an insurance company. This is a company that destroys and demolishes other people's life, and you don't want to be associated with such an insurance company. Your insurance is in a just, equitable, democratic United States of America, not in a powerful settler colonial state of Israel. Palestine is still the issue because it is connected also to Islamophobia. It has a long history of connection to the fear of Muslims just because they are Muslims. The Balfour Declaration, in which Britain gave something that didn't belong to it to a movement it didn't belong to. The two motives for the British Empire to take part of the Middle East, part of the Arab world, part of the Muslim world, and to grant it to a new ideological movement and promise that the empire would do its utmost to create a homeland there, the two major motives were, surprisingly, anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. There was a fear of Islam, there was a fear of Muslims, very much at the heart of the British policy makers who were about to take the Middle East as a new possession in the empire that already was very big. And they much preferred to have non-Muslim enclaves and kingdoms, if they could, in the new domains, in the new possessions. And at the same time, it was a double bill as far as the Jews were concerned. Here were a group of Jews who came to them and said, we want to leave Europe and to colonize Palestine. This was good news for someone like Arthur Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary. He could see how he can get rid of the Jews and at the same time have a non-Muslim British colony in the Holy Land, which he hoped one day would be restored to the glory of the days of the Crusaders. So Islamophobia, in many ways, or put it differently, Palestinians were the first victims of Islamophobia in modern times. They are also the last victims of Islamophobia in our times. It is the fear of Islam, it is the hatred of Islam, it is the animosity to Muslims just because they are Muslims that helped Israel to stop almost a natural process in the United States at the very end of the last century, in which Americans, because of the easy access to information, to knowledge, began to understand what was going on the ground in Palestine. It was the major tool by which Israel, after 2001, associated terrorism with Palestinians in a way that stifled any proper discussion about Israel, Zionism, and Palestine in this country. And we are witnessing it again and again, that attempt to associate violence that is carried out by desperate people in Europe and their supporters with justification for the state terror that Israel exercises against the Palestinians. So if you have a discussion about Palestine, you have a genuine discussion about terror, not a false discussion about terror. You have a genuine discussion about the causes of violence, both in the Middle East, both in Brussels, in Paris, in the United States, and everywhere in the world. You have a much better conversation of what connects or how Palestine is connected to desperation, to violence, if you focus on that country and you don't allow the conversation about terror and the Islamophobic discourse to stifle any genuine discussion about the systematic structure violation of human rights against the Palestinian that has started in the late 19th century and has not stopped for even one day. Palestine is still the issue because it is also an issue of social justice. It is not surprising that you can see in various parts of the world workers who would demonstrate for better pay, for better conditions, who are engaged in industrial action. You will not be surprised to see them don themselves with the Palestinian flag. Because for them, Palestine is the ultimate symbol of injustice. Not only national injustice, not only political injustice, but also social injustice. And you have to ask yourself, why Palestine? Why is the Palestinian flag such an emblem for struggles who, at least on the face of it, have nothing to do with Palestine? And then you understand that it's not because these people think that the atrocities committed against the Palestinians are the worst. Not because they don't know about other cases of inhumanity. Not because they have singled out Israel as the worst rogue state in the world. They are very familiar with worse rogue states that exist. They are very knowledgeable of other inhumanities which are far worse than what the Palestinians had ever experienced and hopefully would ever experience. It's not out of ignorance that they decided that the Palestinian flag symbolizes a struggle for social justice. Social justice, more than anything else, is a struggle against double talk, against hypocrisy, against exceptionalism, against deception. And no other case of violation of human rights and civil rights can compare with the case of Palestine when it comes to exceptionalism, deception, and double talk. This is something we are all familiar with and we know. It is not only the cruelty of the occupier, the inhumanity of the colonizer. It is the pretense of those who support these actions that this is not what that what we see is not a crime, but rather a war of defense, a democratic action, a justified moral policy. We are all familiar both with the double talk, with the language, with the fury, the pretentious fury, the righteous fury that goes along with and accompanies the atrocities on the ground. It is this hypocrisy, more than anything else, that symbolizes for workers around the world the way that they are being treated by their employers, by the multinational corporation, and therefore you can see how many people today understand that the fate of the native as a victim, who was a victim in a settler colonialist project, is the fate of the worker today in the neoliberal system that we are living in. And we will see more and more fusion between the struggle against the inhumanity of shutting a factory, causing the end of a cycle of life in the United States, and the dispossession of the Palestinian from their villages, water resources, and their homeland. The logic of elimination and dehumanization is not just the logic of political movements, it also is the logic of heartless economic powers that control our life. And I think many people, especially in Europe, but I have seen it here in 2008 as well, understand the connection between Flint, Ferguson, Palestine, India, Pakistan, Africa. This is part. You are not only struggle against the criminal policy, you are struggle against the narrative that claims that this is not crime, that this is not a crime, that this is for the benefit of the people. The whole discourse that pretends to improve people's life but actually destroys them is exemplified in Palestine on a daily, if not an hourly, basis. And I think that's why people all around the world see their own struggle so strongly associated and connected with the struggle for peace and justice in Palestine. And I'm very hopeful in this respect because I think we were misled by the movement in the United States in particular after the crisis of 2008. There was a very energetic response to the crisis. You're all familiar with that. In different towns, in different cities in the United States, and it petered out. So analysts in the ivory towers of academia said, well, it's gone. This is it. The crisis is over. The reaction to the crisis is over. I think they are totally wrong. This is just the beginning of a mass movement of young people who had enough with the cynicism of politics, whether it is domestic politics, financial politics, economic politics, or foreign politics. The way America behaves in the Middle East as a whole, it's the immunity it grants Israel, and the domestic policies are all seen as part of a cynical system of politics that has no moral backbone, has no set of values, and has lost the confidence of the people. It is quite it is quite ironic that both in England and in this country, the people who seem to represent at least partly this new young energy and wish for cleaner politics, for morality in politics, are represented by people who are nearly 80 years old. This is wrong. This is not good. May they live very long, but I would have liked to see 20 years old representing these ambitions. I would settle for 65. But there's something in the old values that these two gentlemen represent that the young people recognize as cleaner, as purer, as something that doesn't have the hypocrisy that politics has. And it's not surprising that in the case of Jeremy Corbyn in England, Palestine is the main issue on which he is attacked. And I can assure you, if Bernie Sanders would find the courage to go an extra mile of the 2 yards that he's already walked towards us, if he will take the extra mile, he would find that Palestine is the issue which will define him very much as any other topic he would decide to bring to this campaign. Finally, I would say, and this is very, very important, Palestine is the issue of human rights today. And this is the reason, I think, for so many of us, this is such an important historical juncture. And when I say us, I mean Palestinians, people who support the Palestinians, Israeli Jews, anyone who is involved as an NGO, as an activist, as someone who lives there or someone who was expelled from there. For us, 2016 is a very critical moment. The Palestinians will have to redefine their project of liberation and adapt it to 2016. It is very difficult, given the fragmentation, which is the greatest Zionist success. The Palestinians were fragmented to five different groups. Naturally, these groups developed, each one of them developed its own agenda. But we need a united Palestinian front. We need a united Palestinian representative bodies. None of the bodies that exist today represent faithfully the needs and aspirations of the Palestinian. They usually represent a slice of the Palestinian issue, and that kind of slice always serves well the Israelis and those who want to harm the Palestinian people. So I think this is the moment where you have to find a way of redefining the struggle for liberation in Palestine as the most important human rights and civil rights issue in the world. It is possible. The energy you hear from young people all around the world is there, ready to put Palestine at the center as the symbol for the struggles for human rights, civil rights, and social justice around the world. But you cannot do it without representation which is authentic and unified of the Palestinian people. The second thing that we have to take into account, and I'm saying this with some depredation because I read the Mecca literature, which I hope is outdated, because there is a commitment to two-state solution there. I'll be sensitive. I'll be delicate. Let me put it this way. I'll try and do it the best I can. 2016, and we have, well, we have another good 7 months for that year, right? This is the second half of 2016 should be the time where we all would be invited to the funeral of the two-state solution. The body is already in the morgue. It's every now and then there's an American negotiator who takes the body out of the morgue, puts some life into it, like Jesus, and makes us feel as if it's still alive and tells us it's just around the corner. But apparently that corner is not on Earth, it's somewhere in Mars. It's time to stop this charade, not because it's right or wrong, because it really does not allow us to have a genuine discussion about the alternative. You cannot have a serious discussion of a different way forward if you still stick to a formula that is irrelevant, has nothing to do with the reality on the ground, is also not a just one. And I think in this respect, we have to try and persuade people not to be afraid and say, whether they were genuine supporters of the two-state solution, whether they were cynical supporters of the two-state solution, it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It's a time to say, maybe it could have worked, maybe it was a good idea. One can understand why even some Palestinians strongly supported it. In 2016, it's a waste of time, it's a waste of energy, it's a waste of human effort that is deeply needed, urgently needed, for finding a different way forward. You cannot do both things. You cannot protect a failed formula and talk of a new formula. You have to bury, you know, you have to bury the idea that, frankly speaking, is the idea that provided immunity for Israel to kill more Palestinians, to make more Palestinian refugees, to demolish Palestinian life and houses, to take more of Palestine, and to render any just solution even more distant than it was before this ill-thought idea was introduced as the only way forward for peace and reconciliation in Palestine. So I think Palestine is still the issue because we need new thinking on Palestine. We need fresh thinking on Palestine. And it doesn't matter exactly how you're going to frame the idea of a one-state solution. It doesn't matter what exactly you bring to the table when you say, I want to replace the hegemonic language of peace that has helped Israel to continue to destroy Palestine rather than bring peace and reconciliation. It doesn't matter what you bring to the table, but bring something new to the table and don't rehash formulas and ideas that only benefited those who wanted to destroy Palestine, not those who wanted to bring peace and reconciliation. I say this with some trepidation because some of our best friends still believe in it. Some of them even religiously still believe in it. But it's time to talk to them as well and to tell them we need you on our side. We need every good person inside and outside, a Palestinian and a non-Palestinian, to join forces with us and find out how do we respect the human rights, the civil rights of both the native population of Palestine and the settler community that now is in its third generation. How do we help them to build a political system that rectifies the evils of the past and promises good future life for everyone who is there and everyone who was expelled from there. This is a very important topic. And I will end by saying that this is a particularly important issue because I think it is connected to everything that goes on in the rest of the Middle East. We have to remember that before Zionism arrived in Palestine, although there was violence, and definitely there was violence, although there were wars in the Middle East, the logic, the two logics I was talking about, of dehumanization, of physical elimination, of elimination, were quite strange to the Middle East. I'm not idealizing the Middle East, I'm just saying that it was European enlightenment that invented settler colonialism, that gave license in the name of enlightenment and progressiveness, the right to dehumanize other people to the extent that you could hunt them as animals in Australia and to kill them as if they were not human beings in the United States of America. This is something that is still an open wound, and Palestine is the bleeding part of that wound. And I think that you have to understand what happens in the rest of the Middle East if you can see that elimination and dehumanization of the Palestinians is not only possible because Israel is strong, is not only possible because Israel has the military capacity to do it, it is possible because Israel has an exceptional treatment in the international community, because it has a license to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians in 1948, and not one international body says anything. It has the license to expel 300,000 Palestinians from the West Bank in 1967, and nobody says a word, including within the more conscientious sections of the Western society. So the whole Middle East is watching and says, the problem is not inhumanity. The problem is not eliminating human beings or treating them as, or dehumanizing them. That is not the problem. The problem is whether you are a member of the exceptional club who is allowed to do it. And Israel is the sole member of this club in the Middle East. So if we want to have, and we need, everybody would agree in this hall, we need urgently a genuine conversation about human rights and civil rights in the Middle East. This is the most urgent problem in Syria, in Iraq. The inhumanity of the governments, the inhumanity of the groups that oppose the governments are at the heart of the bloodshed that we see today, together with imperial interests that exploit the situation in order to increase the flames of the fire rather than to try and bring it down. But you can never have a genuine conversation about human rights and civil rights as long as the exceptionalism of Israel continues. So if you want to talk to Syrians about human rights and civil rights, start in Palestine. Don't start in Damascus. If you want to talk about human rights in Yemen, in Libya, start in Palestine. People will then believe that you really care about human rights, about civil rights, and Palestine could be the place where it's not only still the issue, but it also can push the issue of human rights and civil rights, and then maybe we will understand why it used to be called the Holy Land. Because now it is anything, it is the Hollow Land and not the Holy Land, and we have to bring it back to its historical, ethical, and moral, probably place in history by having this kind of conversation. So I will end by saying that don't let anyone tell you that Palestine, the Palestine issue, is less important than any other issue. Don't give up on Palestine and the Palestinians, and be brave enough to put aside slogans, formulas, solutions which are irrelevant, that are negative, that are destructive, and join the new energy that we are feeling coming out from many parts of Palestine and Palestinian life that wishes to create normal life, democratic life, human life for anyone who lives between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, and anyone who was expelled from that homeland and wishes to come back. Thank you.
You have been listening to Israeli historian and author Ilan Pappe speaking to the Middle East Children's Alliance in Berkeley, California.
Being manipulated and controlled and guided into a new world order and a new world religion? Yes. Is there a group in charge of this who's been in charge all along who are bringing this about? Yes. And I can tell you, folks, they're as old as man. They are the followers of an ancient religion that has persisted even unto this day.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The curious case of the MKO. Is the US happy to train terrorists so long as they're blowing up Iranians? Years ago this week, one of the most horrific terrorist attacks ever, killing a president, a prime minister and several cabinet ministers when a suitcase blew up when it was opened in their faces. The terror group is still active and the US removed the MKO from terrorist lists. They're now being trained by the West for further terrorist attacks against Iran and Iranian people. Plus, a small matter of China moving into Syria and now formally backing Bashar al-Assad. Also, survivors of Chile's Nazi paedophile torture compound, Colonia Dignidad, have been speaking out. But who put Pinochet in place? We hear from the horse's mouth, the CIA's deputy director at the time, Tom Braden. Also, astroturfing. Why haven't Wikipedia acted to stop big corporations and powerful individuals spinning their own Wikipedia pages and erasing embarrassing misdeeds? And to mark back-to-school week, Monday, a real brain teaser. The old Confederate General's letter, covered by the Daily Mail and the Express now too, which suggests World Wars 1 and 2, as well as a coming World War 3 between Islam and Zionism, were all planned by this senior general 200 years ago. Our sister show Dialects back at noon every Tuesday. This week, the first ever interview with Michael Tyler. You just heard from just before the news there, who's a full-art interview with him, who compiled a definitive list of bankers who've died mysteriously since 2006 and the 2008 bailouts. There are about 70 on his list. Also, nearly 250 Germans have been on a two-week friendship mission from Berlin to Moscow and back, covered in the Russian news, the TV, the radio and the newspapers, but the German TV sent a reporter along and they never reported a thing about the tour. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. But let's start this week, Martin, with something from the news bulletins. It's kind of putting you on the spot here, but we've had this arrest down in Somerset near Yeovil of a Royal Marine who it looks as if has been involved in some kind of terrorist incident to do with Northern Ireland. And there are parts of his home here in Somerset and in Northern Ireland that have been searched by the police. Some army munitions found that it seems that he may have taken, and also possibly even homemade explosive devices. Now, this is really worrying, as this seems to be a serving officer here.
He's not an officer.
Not an officer, a serving soldier.
Yeah, well, I mean, we don't know the full detail of this. I think they discovered an arms cache in County Antrim, and which had homemade bomb-making equipment and claymore mines in it. And I believe the claymore...
Can you just tell us, what is a claymore mine?
Well, I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, Tony. It's a kind of a mine, but the point about it is it's a British Army standard issue mine. And the question when the police found this arms cache was, where did they get these mines from? And I think that's what's led back to this guy being arrested.
Also, he's actually been charged now with terror offences. 30-year-old Royal Marine from Northern Ireland appears in court charged with terror offence related to dissident republicanism. I mean, is it possible that the army is there any track record of this kind of links between the army and dissident republicans? It sounds like impossible, really, because surely they're both on the opposite sides of this conflict.
Well, look, I mean, many IRA activists were ex-British Army soldiers from the very beginning of the Troubles onwards. And it looks to me as if he may have been encouraged to join the army by his real IRA handlers.
And we don't know. Does it happen the other way around? Do the army ever try and infiltrate these groups?
Of course. Of course, that's been going on all along.
And how well is that controlled? I mean, is the infiltration just gathering evidence, or do they sometimes kind of almost go...
Well, look, I mean, there was Donal McIntyre's Panorama documentary, which was about this time last year, it came out, I believe, was covering the whole murky tale of the role of the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland. And, Nuala O'Lone, who's the police ombudswoman, is quoted in the film as saying, well, we've got direct evidence that the British Army have been involved in the killing of hundreds of civilians in Northern Ireland.
Well, today, Kieran Maxwell has been charged with the following offences between 1st of January 2011 and 21st of August 2016, with the intention of assisting another to commit acts of terrorism engaged in conflict in preparation for giving effect to this intention, namely research resulting in the creation of a library of documents providing information of a kind likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing acts of terrorism. Information regarding the manufacture of explosive substances, the construction of explosive devices and tactics used by terror organisations. Also, he's been charged with purchasing or otherwise obtaining articles for a purpose connected with the commission, preparation or instigation of an act of terrorism, chemicals and components to be used in the manufacture of explosive substances, construction, and also an image of an adapted Police Service of Northern Ireland pass card, items from a PSNI uniform. Also, he's been charged with manufacturing explosive substances, constructing explosive devices, creating and maintaining hides in England and Northern Ireland to store explosive substances, components for explosive devices, ammunition, weapons, tools and resources. And, you know, this does seem to be a pretty long catalogue. There are two other charges as well. One is... on the 24th of August, possession of a quantity of controlled drugs, namely cannabis, with intent to supply, and also in possession of articles, bank cards and associated CVC numbers for use in connection with fraud. So the main charge clearly is the first one of terrorism, and it just seemed like he was, you know, that this will obviously all come out in court, but he may have been actually part of a terrorist gang whilst a serving British soldier.
Well, I mean, he's what's unusual about this is that he's part of a terrorist gang on the Republican side, whereas, of course, in actual fact, the collusion between, in particular, the Ulster Defence Regiment and the Loyalist paramilitaries is much, much more common.
And is it not impossible that he may have been infiltrating this gang, and that's why he had this equipment?
Listen, I don't know is the simple answer
to
that.
What I'm saying is there any track record of this kind of thing happening, like the British Army?
If he'd been infiltrating on behalf of the Army, then they wouldn't be being charged, would he? It's an unusual case in one way, but I mean, as I come back to the point I made earlier, the investigations by the Northern Ireland Police Ombudswoman have shown that the British Army's Force Research Unit, operating in Belfast and across the six counties during the Troubles, was directly responsible for the murder of hundreds of civilians. I repeat that, directly responsible. You've got, and people, when there was a ceasefire and an agreement, it wasn't just the IRA who had to cease fire. The British Army had to cease fire as well, and of course, the difference between IRA activists who get 25 years in prison for killing people and British Army officers like Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's the head of the Force Research Unit, is that they don't go to prison.
Well, let's go straight from Antrim to Tehran, and Iran is marking the anniversary of the 1981 bombing at the then Prime Minister's office in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The President Mohammad al-Rajai and then Prime Minister Mohammad Javad Bahonar lost their lives in a bombing in the capital, Tehran, 35 years ago today. The Islamic Republic of Iran is marking that anniversary, and the list of those cabinet ministers as well, three cabinet ministers, survivors said an aide identified as Massoud Kashmiri had brought a briefcase into the conference room, placed it in the two high-ranking Iranian political figures and then left. An explosion occurred when one of the victims opened the briefcase. The blast killed three other members of the Islamic Republican Party as well as the two key people in the government, the Prime Minister and the President, Martin.
Yes, well, MKO, who carried out the bombing, I think they used to be known as MEK, they're very strange actors.
Mujahideen el-Kuk organisation, known as MKO and MEK as well.
Yeah, well, they're a pretty sinister outfit with a rather cultish leader, and they were basically came out of the Iranian Revolution. They were Islamist Marxists was their original orientation. I remember reading some of their literature years ago, but of course they've been taken up by Western powers as a means of putting pressure on the Iranian government, and just like the British Army's Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland carrying out acts of terrorism, British and US intelligence services quite happily cooperate with terrorists across the planet.
Tehran's Friday prayers leader Ayatollah Khatami, he's saying, I mean, I don't know whether this is true or not, but he's saying the MKO has the darkest record before the Iranian nation, as the terrorist group has carried out 17,000 assassinations against innocent people as part of its criminal record. And what he's really annoyed about is that certain governments are chanting the slogan of campaign against terrorism, but actually actively supporting the MKO still to this day, indicating their agenda is not human rights and confronting terrorism at all.
No, and it's not. It's similar to what's been going on in Syria, where the Western powers and their Gulf allies have been happily arming and training the most extreme terrorists you could possibly imagine.
It seems that special forces are often in these countries without any sanction of parliament as well, up to no good, and training up possible terrorists in those countries. Well, so whereabouts do you think in the Middle East, could there be some of our soldiers, special forces in Iran even?
It's quite likely that people are infiltrated into Iran. And of course, we know that British special forces are operating from Jordan and into the north, the southern part of Syria, and they're operating in Libya, and of course they're operating with terrorists. they arm and train these terrorists. The Al-Nusra Front has changed its name in northern Syria to the something else Sham Front.
The Sham Liberation Front.
The Sham Liberation Army, or whatever they're now called.
Sham Liberation Front.
Sham Liberation Front. And, of course, by changing their name, they're suddenly no longer Al-Qaeda, which is what they were originally, and now the Americans have supplied them with missiles that can take down planes and tanks. Wonderful.
Also, staying with that region, China has entered the fray in Syria on Bashar al-Assad's side. This is the Irish Times, but I've hardly seen any reporting of this. This is the thing I find so amazing nowadays. A massive story like China bringing its people into Syria to try and prop up the government of Bashar al-Assad is a massive move. I mean, these are not small stories. This is what's going on here is countries that are part of the Security Council have not been able to settle their difference in the Security Council, so they're sending their various troops from these various Security Council countries into Syria.
Well, don't forget the Chinese have got a vested interest in this, because operating within Syria are Uyghur military formations, which have been trained and armed by the Turks because they speak a Turkic language. And they are also behind terrorist attacks inside China itself in Xinjiang province. And, the Chinese, if they go and intervene in Syria, it will be to try and, one of the reasons will be to try and, counteract these people. Because, of course, by fighting in Syria, they're getting all the expertise and experience that they can take back into China. That's another reason why the Russians are intervening, because they can see these people coming. You know, there's lots of Chechens fighting in Syria, for example. In fact, most of the armed groups operating in the anti-government side are not made up of Syrians at all. And, of course, that's all been orchestrated by our friends in the intelligence services.
I mean, they call them advisors that they're sending in there. They're helping out the military. Obviously, if the Chinese government is sending in some of their military people.
They're just sending advisors, as far as I know, at this stage.
But an advisor is often trained people, and they're often militarily trained. I'm just amazed at the lack of coverage here, really, because you look at, for example, the only thing I could see anywhere in the press in our part of the world was in the Financial Times. It says Chinese foreign policy throwing out the rule book.
One of the things that the standoff in the South China Sea, which has been precipitated by the Americans pushing the Philippines to take the Chinese to the International Court in The Hague to get a ruling against them. It's bizarre because they were taken to a court of arbitration, and the basic principle of arbitration is that both sides have got to agree to it. So the Chinese said, well, we're not going to agree to it. We don't want to go to arbitration. But the Americans have forced the Filipinos to go to arbitration. And it's them that have been stirring this up from behind the scenes. It's what they sometimes call lead from behind. And, of course, the Chinese are not very happy with it. It's provocative. It's annoying them. So the way they respond is by popping up in Syria.
I'd just like to say well done to the Irish Times, being just about the only people in the entire British Isles to have actually had a look at this very important issue. They're saying that Moscow, Beijing and Tehran have serious reasons for backing Damascus. Russian and Chinese ties go to Syria go back to the Cold War, when the Soviet Union, the People's Republic of China, supported and armed the Arabs against Israel. Iran and Syria became allies in 1980 following the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Now, that's just before this big bomb attack that we were being told about here. So basically, when the Iranians kicked out the Americans from Iran in 1979, it seems that the Russians and the Chinese were straight into the region and particularly saw Syria as an important point to bolster. How's this all going to end up, though, Martin? Because you've now got the Americans in, you've got the British in, you've got the Turks in, you've got the Chinese in, and you've got the Russians all in Syria.
Well, there's a potential here for miscalculation, which will lead to outright fighting between NATO forces and Russian, Syrian and Iranian forces. It's just about been avoided so far. But there's no guarantee that we will continue to avoid such conflict.
So what happens if, say, the Russians shoot down an American aircraft, or the British shoot down a Russian plane, for example? Because obviously the air power and control of the air is one of the major things that some of the people, ordinary people like ISIS, etc., are running around on the ground. But air power is where it all happens, isn't it?
It is, and of course the Americans have been supplying the so-called moderate al-Qaeda rebels in Syria with ground-to-air missiles. But nevertheless, it seems that they're not as effective as they used to be, because the Russians' countermeasures are actually quite good. Back in the 80s, when they were supplying Stinger missiles to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, they were able to basically force the Russians out, because they couldn't bring in air support, and helicopters were very vulnerable to these things. But it looks as if the latest generation of Russian aircraft are not as vulnerable as they previously were.
So do you think NATO's on a hiding to nothing trying to oust Assad?
Well, what's really sad about all of this is the war could come to an end if Assad and his allies were allowed to win it. I mean, Aleppo is the last stand of the terrorists, or whatever you want to call them. They don't actually control most of the population in Aleppo. Most of the population has fled to the government-controlled areas, and about 70% of the population of Syria is in government-controlled areas. And the areas controlled by the so-called rebels, most people have fled from those areas because it's intolerable circumstances. In the long run, when the history comes to be written, the perfidious role that's been played, particularly by the British government in this conflict, will have to be addressed. But I mean, if we're going to send down Royal Marines who are planning terrorism in Northern Ireland, maybe we should send some of our top intelligence people to prison, because they do seem to be supporting terrorism,
and possibly,
including al-Qaeda terrorism.
Well, and possibly police too. British police have been criticised this week for lack of transparency in the Bahrain training deal. This is Kevin Rawlinson in The Guardian. British police have been criticised because they refused to release details of an international deal to train security officials from Bahrain, country accused of a litany of human rights abuses. Human rights campaigners have said the College of Policing, which sets standards for UK officers and offers worldwide training courses, should be compelled to explain their work in countries with bad records of civil liberties. Concerns come less than 2 months after MPs criticised the totally unacceptable opacity around the college's provision of training to Saudi Arabia. This is pretty pernicious, isn't it? We're training what effectively are two, I think it's fair to say police states here.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, the other thing that people may not realise is that we're going to open a new British naval base in Bahrain. The locals don't want it, but Bahrain was a British colony until 1971, when it was then handed over to the Khalifa family by the British. And Saudi Arabia invaded during 2011, and they came straight over the causeway and put down the Shia democracy protesters, and we are implicated in all of that. We're implicated in it all completely.
Yes, I seem to remember that police officer John Yates, who interviewed Tony Blair over Cash for Questions and then disappeared off to Bahrain to help train this. So it does seem to there's this kind of relationship there. I mean, is it fair to train anybody in policing, no matter if they're a kind of police state regime? And we're making some money out of this, apparently £8.6 million.
The simple answer to that is no, it's not. They shouldn't be doing it. Why are they doing it? And, of course, the British police officers are operating in Bahrain up to now. Unlike in Syria, the opposition in Bahrain hasn't resorted to armed struggle. But if they were to do so, they'd have exactly the same right as people in Syria. In fact, more, because the people in Syria are not supported by the majority of the population. But I understand that the opposition in Bahrain is not prepared to go to war, but if they were, and they were to kill some of these police officers who are doing the training, well, I'm afraid that would be that, wouldn't it? That's what this is all about. If you want to get your finger into that sort of mess, then, you could end up with a bullet in the back of the head, couldn't you?
Staying with the Middle East, Tel Aviv has just approved 463 settlement homes yesterday in the occupied lands. Israel approved Wednesday construction of 463 homes for settlers in the occupied West Bank. The watchdog Peace Now has said the move drew sharp rebuke from the US. Washington said it was deeply concerned by the announcement, with senior US officials slamming the pervasive advancement of settlement activity in a new and potentially unlimited way. Approvals mostly included new housing units, but a retroactive green light was also granted to 179 existing homes in the Ofarim settlement. Around 50 new units received final approval Benjamin Netanyahu, Israeli Prime Minister, continues to plan and build all over the West Bank, whilst also giving settlers the message that any construction done without planning will be retroactively legalised, Peace Now said.
Well, you've got to ask yourself the question, why is Israel still a member of the United Nations? If they're not prepared to play by the rules, they should be booted out of the club. And we can discuss whether we're going to recognise Kosovo or not. If we can discuss that, we can discuss why is Israel, a country about the same size as Kosovo, why have they got a seat at the United Nations? Perhaps they shouldn't have one.
And why are the Americans continuing to supply them with fantastic amounts of money and arms, etc.? They're saying that they think this is a... they're deeply concerned. This is a rebuke from US officials, but no real action. I mean, do they mean it, the Americans, when they say that they shouldn't do this?
Well, they're going through the motions. They feel as if they have to say something, because it's become, if they don't say something, then they look as if they're completely biased, which in fact they generally are. And of course, what happens is the Israelis get massive amounts of money. I mean, every Israeli citizen is subsidised to the tune of several thousand dollars per head per year by the US taxpayer. And in other words, the potential for making them behave themselves is quite big. If that subsidy was withdrawn, lots of the people living in Israel, including in the occupied territories, might decide that they were better off going back to the United States of America, where most of them were born. But they stay in Israel because they're subsidised by the US taxpayer to do so. Is that a viable or sensible strategy? No, it's not. And I'm afraid... You know, the running sore that is what's going on there just adds to the general chaos and tension in the region, doesn't it?
Also staying with the Israelis, an Israeli fugitive tech titan by the name of Kobe Alexander has been jailed in New York. Now, he's someone that we've mentioned on this show a couple of times, years gone by, Martin, but he's kind of fallen off the radar. Kobe Alexander is the chief executive of a company called Converse Infosys, which was back in 2001, December 2001, just after the 9/11 attacks, accused of spying in the United States. A very interesting report by Fox News reporter Carl Cameron into that. I mean, basically what they were doing is they were supplying the telephone records and paper records of people's phone calls, but then they were also being linked to the Israeli Secret Service. So they went along to the phone companies in the US and said, we can provide you a very cheap way of printing out all your phone bills and sending them to people, etc. The phone companies said fine, but then they were using all this information basically as a foreign intelligence service who'd managed to infiltrate the United States. But anyway, he was running that company, but he wasn't content with doing that, spying. He also was doing what's called stock option backdating. So that meant that he was saying that he bought stock options retrospectively after the event, when he knew that that was the best time to have bought it. And he didn't actually buy them at all. So he made vast amounts of money personally. And he's agreed now to pay back $60 million to Converse in connection with this litigation, and to waive over $72 million in claims that he had against the company. So this is basically a guy who's been running around the world on the run from the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, in charge of a very important and powerful Israeli firm. But more than that, Converse Infosys is the company that owns a British company. Well, it's actually based in Israel, but it's a British company that was involved in the 7/7 London bombings. At least it was the security company that was involved just before in having the tube security cameras being privatised a few months before the bombings. His company was running that contract. So it's a lot of questions about this guy, this company, and Israeli tech in this story.
Well, yes. And the Israeli high-tech security complex, when you've privatised security at airports, for example, many Western airports are actually run, the security is actually run by a private Israeli firm linked to Mossad called ICTS. And, of course, the suspicion is that many of the attacks in airports, like 9/11 and Brussels and so on, are being facilitated, let's put it that way, by ICTS. They were in charge of Schiphol Airport, for example, when the so-called underpants bomber was led onto the plane with no shoes on and no passport, without going through any security check. As Kurt Haskell, who was a lawyer on the plane, has you know, give an eyewitness statement.
But what I mean, more to the point, what is London Underground doing, employing, giving a contract to a firm whose parent company's chief executive, who's fled to Namibia for 10 years, having absconded with $33 million of his own company's money, and he won't go back to America now. He's just actually just gone back just now, 10 years afterwards, to face one charge. Obviously, a deal has been done where previously he was going to be facing 35 charges. Why are companies like this being employed in this country, or contracts being given to them, when the chief executive of the parent company quite clearly is a crook?
Well, it's because this Israeli security complex, Converse Systems, ICTS, etc., are worming their way. They're using the privatisation process in order to get themselves into positions of, you know, extremely powerful positions running security and CCTV. And the suspicion is, I'm afraid, that the Israeli secret services are terrorists.
It does look
as if they use the positions that they've created in order to facilitate various terrorist attacks, which are then blamed on Islamists.
It does look as if the Americans have been quite subtle about this in a way, that they've used the stock option backdating rap to get this guy for what his company's been doing, stealing information from people's phone records. So they obviously didn't want that to be made a massive public scandal, so they found something else to get him for. This guy's the chief executive here in Britain was Daniel Bodner. He was running Verint Systems, who were the company that was doing the London Underground contract, and Bodner was trained in explosives by the Israeli army. So you do wonder whether there was any kind of motive there for the Israelis grabbing this London Underground contract with a company run by an expert in explosives, and why they weren't kind of questioned in any of the process after the London bombings.
Well, as you know, Benjamin Netanyahu was the finance minister of Israel. He was supposed to go to a meeting at Liverpool Street that morning, and he didn't go. And the Times of Israel phoned up the Israeli embassy after the bombing and said, "Do we want to find out if Bibi's okay, because we understand he was supposed to go to a meeting this morning where one of these bombs went off." And they said, "Don't worry, it's okay. We had a warning," and he didn't leave the building. Now, if I was in charge of the investigation into the 7/7 bombings, I would have immediately surrounded the Israeli embassy, cut off the electricity and the water, and said to them, "Right, you tell us where you got your warning from. Where did you get a warning?"
And maybe Dan Shaham, that's Dan Shehaam, would have given you an answer, because he was the Israeli spokesperson we revealed exclusively on this show a few years ago on one of the 7/7 anniversaries. He was the Israeli spokesperson at the embassy that had given that information to various journalists that morning, saying that we had a warning around about 8 a.m, over an hour before the bombs actually went off on 7/7. Very few people know that, and it seems there's been no proper investigation into the potential Israeli embassy involvement in those bombs. Anyway, next story, the bizarre media blackout of hacked George Soros documents. Leaked documents released this last week provide juicy insider details of how a fabulously rich businessman has been using his money to influence elections in Europe and underwrite an extremist group. Also, target US citizens who disagree with him, dictate foreign policy and try to sway a Supreme Court ruling. Pretty compelling stuff, right? Not if it involves leftist billionaire George Soros. In this case, the mainstream press couldn't care less, says Tyler Durden at Zero Hedge. On Saturday, a group called DC Leaks posted more than 2,500 documents going back to 2008 that it got from George Soros' Open Society Foundation servers. Since then, the mainstream media have shown zero interest in this goldmine of information. Sounds like a kind of mini WikiLeaks, Martin, but why haven't the... He's quite right. He's saying there's no stories in the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, CBS or other major Western news sites that even noted the existing of these existence of these leaked documents, let alone reported on what's on them. So who is this guy George Soros, and what's he doing with these 90 different financial grants to various organisations that are trying to fix elections during 2014, just for one example?
Well, he's a very powerful individual with a very, an explicit agenda.
Is he powerful enough to tell the London media, "No, I don't want you to report on these leaks"?
Yeah, pretty much. Don't forget, he provides a lot of funds to a lot of different people. and if you were to cross him, then maybe he wouldn't provide you with the resources that you wanted. So that obviously people tread very carefully around him. I mean, he was very much involved in the coup in the Ukraine. So a lot of the things he funds have a sort of superficially progressive character, although I would suggest that any progressives who take Soros's money need to take a very long spoon.
Well, one of these grants...
But in the Ukraine, he's taken a much more kind of essentially hawkish line.
One of these grants, for example, is $200,000 to conduct a major smear campaign against conservative activists. In October 2015, a document came to light that's showing... that his open society programs donated $650,000 to invest in technical assistance and support for groups at the burgeoning Black Lives Matter movement. Since then, several Black Lives Matter protests have turned violent. The same document details how this group successfully used its extensive networks to pressurize the Obama administration into increasing the number of refugees it would take to 100,000, despite concerns that Islamic terrorists could use the refugee program to infiltrate the US. So it does seem as if that there are lots of these little NGOs out there that could survive without this guy. He's basically kind of creating loads of these little sock puppet organisations, which are quietly being funded by him. I mean, of course, you know, people do need a job, they do need a living, and it would be nice if George Soros would knock on our door, actually, Martin, and say, here's a £600,000 grant for your radio show. But he's not going to do that, is he? He's interested in creating almost a kind of civil society opposition right across the Western world.
Yeah, and obviously very, very much involved in what went on in Eastern Europe and elsewhere.
And he's also
the Arab Spring and so forth.
Quite a lot of groups in Russia in order to try and overthrow Putin.
He's found it more difficult to operate in Russia because the Russians got fed up with you can't just have people funding the stuff which is designed to destabilise your country. You've got to have some rules about that. You can't just, for example, you can't have anybody just turning up in Britain and spending any amount of money on our elections.
Well, one person that did report on this is Breitbart News, Chris Tomlinson, and he's saying that the left-wing think tank that released a controversial report about Islamophobia on Twitter was directly funded by George Soros' Open Society Foundation. Demos released a new report that conflates Islamophobia with any criticism of Islam. It claimed on Friday, a couple of weeks ago, that Islamic phobic tweets have become so frequent that Twitter should actively engage in censorship to stop the comments. Leaked documents from the Open Society Foundation show George Soros' organisation funded Demos to conduct this research over social media platforms like Twitter. So this is effectively lobbying for this report, which then becomes almost like mainstream news, and people use it to try and pretend to governments and to policymakers, and I suppose to executives at Twitter, that something needs to be done.
Well, I mean, far be it from me to defend Islamophobia on Twitter. What's very unsettling about Soros is some of the things that he believes in are generally progressive ideas. But it's still something deeply suspicious and worrying when somebody's got such a strong agenda like that. And as I say, in the Ukraine in particular, far from pursuing a progressive agenda, George Soros has very much been in favour of supporting what are basically neo-Nazis to overthrow the Yanukovych regime.
It does make you wonder when you see a report whether it's just one of these kind of Soros-funded or someone else has funded it, and there's an agenda and a whole bunch of load of money behind it, whether it's in any kind of way journalistic. Balanced and honest.
Well, as I think in a sense, you've got, as long as people say where they're getting their money from, they're entitled to have some money to do reports, aren't they? They've got to tell us where the money comes from.
A lot of the time they don't, and that this is leaked in leaks like this, which are then not reported, because I suppose in a way it's a bit embarrassing for big organisations like the BBC that say 10 or 20 of their stories over the last month have just been funded by Soros.
Indeed. And I think, obviously, he's in the sights of conservative activists in the US. And, of course, it's not just Soros, of course. You've got Sheldon Adelson and the Koch brothers and other various billionaires, what Bernie Sanders calls the billionaire class. They are basically, they buy everything that's not nailed down. And that's where we're at. I mean, the democracy is a pretty threadbare thing, isn't it?
getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
On to take a look at the US presidential elections. Been chugging along. We do touch on it from week to week, but I thought we had a pretty good look this week, Martin, because both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been speaking to something called the American Legion this week about US foreign policy. Who are the American Legion and why is this significant in the race to be president?
Well, they're roughly equivalent to the Royal British Legion over here. So it's basically people, ex-members of the US Armed Forces make up the American Legion.
But why is it important?
Well, it's seen as a key demographic that, you know, that politicians want to persuade.
Sort of former servicemen and servicewomen. So anyway, let's have a listen first of all now to, it was over 2 days, and the first into the traps was Hillary Clinton. So let's have a listen to what she was saying about her intentions for US foreign policy into the future, speaking to the American Legion this week.
Let's modernize our Army and Marines, our Navy and Air Force, our Coast Guard. We need to respond to evolving threats from states like Russia and China, Iran and North Korea, from networks, criminal and terrorist networks like ISIS. We need a military that is ready and agile so it can meet the full range of threats and operate on short notice across every domain, not just land, sea, air and space, but also cyberspace. We'll invest in new technologies so new breakthroughs can transform our military, just as stealth, precision weapons and advanced communications did in the past. We'll make a renewed push to reduce the world's nuclear weapons, because that does make us all safer. And we'll step up our efforts to secure nuclear material around the world and stop terrorists from acquiring or using weapons of mass destruction. One of the first things I will do as president is to call for a new nuclear posture review. We have to make sure that America's arsenal is prepared to meet future threats. We'll invest in the next frontier of military engagement, protecting U.S. interests in outer space and cyberspace. You've seen reports. Russia's hacked into a lot of things. China's hacked into a lot of things. Russia even hacked into the Democratic National Committee. Maybe even some state election systems. So we've got to step up our game, make sure we are well defended and able to take the fight to those who go after us. As president, I will make it clear that the United States will treat cyber attacks just like any other attack. We will be ready with serious political, economic, and military responses. And we're going to invest in protecting our governmental networks and our national infrastructure. I want us to lead the world in setting the rules of cyberspace. If America doesn't, others will. So in short, we have to be ready to win today's fights and tomorrow's.
Well, she's hinting there, Martin, that with a cyber attack against the United States, she would be prepared to retaliate with military force.
Yes, extremely worrying. And of course,
she's effectively saying that this is the infrastructure of the United States, and it can't function without its little internet cyber stuff. So, if someone's having a go, then they're quite within their rights to have a go back.
Indeed, and it's sort of, if you remember that the United States and the Israelis created together the Stuxnet virus, which was designed to mess up the Natanz nuclear reactor in Iran. But that Stuxnet virus then transferred itself into the general cyberspace and probably played some role in what happened at Fukushima. How irresponsible is it for a nation state like the United States to deliberately create viruses which are designed to cripple crucial infrastructure in foreign countries? I think that's there's one rule for them and another rule for everybody else, isn't it?
Well, Jan Stoltenberg, who's Secretary General of NATO, he said just after this year's Bilderberg meeting, which we covered and I was over at in Dresden, this is the main political NATO zone lobby by big business, bankers and royalty, basically run the Western world pretty much, it seems, but he's saying a massive cyber attack could trigger a NATO response. So it seems that Hillary Clinton is absolutely in line with what NATO is saying about this, and that the next question, which neither of them have asked, is how, when there is some kind of cyber attack, how you identify where it's come from. And we're talking about things like a cyber attack on our electricity infrastructure, possibly gas infrastructure. The Internet of Things has opened all of our worlds, including not just our PCs, but much of our crucial infrastructure now, up to hackers. We're talking even about aircraft and cars too.
Well, also, of course, there's a potential for the terrorist mastermind sitting inside the intelligence services to fake a cyber attack, as perhaps to cover up a stock market crash or something of that sort. Say the stock market crashes, they can say, well, that wasn't the stock market crashing, that was the Chinese hacking into the Wall Street computers, and it's not our fault, look over there. All of these things are possible because of the belligerent stance which Hillary Clinton was pretty much outlining in that speech. She's basically saying, when I am president, we are going to be on a confrontational course with Russia, China and Iran.
Well, she mentioned also the Democratic National Council, didn't she, and they're being apparently hacked by the Russians too.
Well, there's no evidence that the Russians... I mean, what the evidence suggests that insiders in the Democratic National Council, is it, rather than the convention, were very unhappy with the way she stole
Democratic
the nomination.
National Committee, I think, DNC,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of evidence to suggest that Hillary Clinton basically stole the Democratic nomination through various shenanigans, basically fixing the vote, and the DNC acting basically as a facilitator, which is why Debbie Wasserman Schultz had to resign. And the people who may have leaked it, I mean, Julian Assange has said it's not the Russians that were giving us this stuff. I can tell you that categorically, and he should know because he's the recipient, and he's hinted as broadly as he can that he thinks that this chap, I've forgotten his name now, who was murdered, in supposed robbery where they didn't bother to take his phone or his wallet, he was actually in charge of the IT for the DNC, and it seems likely to me that he's the source of the leaks because he was so unhappy with the way Clinton was basically stealing the election. And of course, she's now diverted attention from what's in those emails by saying this is outrageous. The Russians have done this because they're trying to undermine me. Well, people just need to look at the material that's actually come into light. She's stolen the nomination. Bernie Sanders should be facing off against Trump, but he's not because she's stolen the nomination.
Assange has offered a $20,000 reward, £15,000 reward for any information leading to any conviction in the murder of 27-year-old Democratic National Committee staffer Seth Rich. He was the one who was killed earlier this year in suspected attempted robbery where actually nothing was taken from him, but he was the guy right at the heart of the internet email system that Hillary Clinton seems to be saying was the Russians.
Yes, I mean, it's sinister. It would be laughable if it wasn't so sinister, the kind of thing that she's doing.
Okay, but before we go on to hear from Donald Trump, the wonderful, trying to choose between these two is really not the easiest choice that we can make. It certainly isn't a very democratic choice. There's neocon Robert Kagan spurns the Republican Party and hosts a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. Now, they call him a neocon, Martin, because back in around about 2000, 2001, he was one of the two main people that set up the neoconservative group. And he's now gone from the Republican Party and he's decided he's going to support Hillary as a Democratic. You do wonder, don't you, if actually the real people running America just switch from party to party, whoever they feel is going to be a better candidate for them. And these are the guys behind the war on terror, and they think Hillary's their person for the presidency.
Yes.
Who is this guy, Robert Kagan?
Well, he's a sort of he's a right-wing neoconservative, as you rightly point out, highly thought of in those circles. He's the husband of Victoria Nuland, she of the famous FDEU fame, who orchestrated the coup against Yanukovych in Ukraine. And they see Hillary Clinton as a safe pair of hands to keep stoking the war fires with Russia and China to the benefit of the US military-industrial complex. Very dangerous and very silly. But there you are.
So do you think there's any real choice in this election?
Well, as I said, if Hillary Clinton hadn't stolen the Democratic nomination, which it looks as if she did by basically vote rigging, then it would be Sanders versus Trump. But it's not, is it?
OK, well, let's have a listen now to Donald Trump speaking the day after Hillary Clinton at the American Legion this week.
We are going to end the era of nation building and create a new foreign policy joined by our partners in the Middle East that is focused on destroying ISIS and radical Islamic terrorism. We will extend the hand of friendship to any nation that will work with us in good faith on this vital mission, and we want this mission to be accomplished quickly. At the same time, we will change our immigration screening procedures to help keep terrorists and extremists out of our country. We have enough problems. Our country has enough problems. We don't need that one. And that includes stopping the influx of Syrian refugees. We do not want to let anyone in our country who doesn't support our values and who is not capable of loving our people. It's time to create a new American future for you, your children, and all American children yet to come. In this future, we will have an honest government that includes an honest State Department, not pay for play. She probably didn't mention that to you yesterday. Government access and favors will no longer be for sale, and important email records will no longer be deleted and digitally altered, which is something they just found out 2 days ago. Bleached. Expensive process. Why? 33,000 emails bleached through a very expensive process. You ask yourself, what's going on?
Well, Donald Trump there, clearly Marty making reference to Hillary Clinton's rather damning email trail. But, I mean, you know, what's to say that he's going to be any better?
Well, no, not a lot. I mean, it makes me laugh. He's talking about we are going to fight ISIS. Well, in actual fact, as General Flynn leaked in his report, ISIS was basically facilitated by the U.S. intelligence services. They created them.
One of the people very closely connected with Hillary Clinton is good old Henry Kissinger. He now lives at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, which, by the way, about a year ago was bought by the Chinese. And very clearly, Kissinger is quite close to the Chinese as well as to the Pentagon. Look, Martin, these two together make quite an interesting combination, don't they? Former Secretary of State Kissinger has presented her with a Distinguished Leadership Award from the Atlantic Council in Washington. Obviously, best buddies, whereas it doesn't seem Trump is quite, although he has met with Kissinger, is quite so close. This is a little bit worrying as we go into our next item, which is to do with Chile's torture commune run by Pinochet's paedophile Nazi pal. This was in last month in the Daily Express. Eric Zotchukas lived through the ordeal in the aftermath of Chile's 1973 military coup, as featured in Emma Watson's new film, The Colony. Blindfolded and strapped to a bed in an underground tunnel, the prisoner braces himself, knowing there will be no escape from the agonising electric shocks about to be inflicted. Now, this was the Pinochet fascist regime put in place by Henry Kissinger in 1973, when he was Secretary of State. But, Martin, one of the hideous things about The Colony was that the interrogation was done by remote control, so those being tortured could never identify the people who were doing the torture.
Yes, sickening, really. And there he is, Henry Kissinger, advising Hillary Clinton, who wants to be president of the United States.
So let's have a listen now to a documentary from the mid-1970s, in fact, just a few years after the coup in Chile. And the person speaking here most of the way through is the CIA former Deputy Director Tom Braden, where he talks a little bit about Watergate and then gets into discussing Allende in 1973 and the coup.
Watergate forced the resignation of Richard Nixon and Howard Hunt was jailed. But the CIA didn't escape the remorseless process of investigation which was set in train. Late last year, the post-Watergate insistence on open government unearthed another damaging episode. The CIA had secretly backed the forces which brought down the left-wing government of President Allende in Chile in 1973. The CIA successfully financed Allende's opponents for 15 years, but in 1970 they miscalculated his support and did little to help the opposition. Allende, a Marxist, won by a small majority in a democratic election. Secretary of State Kissinger was disturbed. With President Nixon's agreement, he ordered an economic freeze on Chile. The CIA also went into action behind the scenes, and in the next 3 years, millions of dollars were spent in efforts to undermine Allende. But before these facts came out, Richard Helms, the CIA's director during the Chile campaign, had testified on oath before Congress that the agency played no part in Allende's downfall.
When he stood up before the Senate to testify, he was asked certain questions about his operations in Chile. He was asked, "Did you spend any money to overthrow the Allende government?" And he said, "No, sir." He asked if he had conducted any covert activities against the Allende government, and he said, "No, sir." And for that, he probably, in the post-Watergate era, will be indicted for perjury. That's a decision we'll learn about in a few weeks. Because shortly after he had made that statement, his predecessor, Colby, went up to Congress and told him the truth.
How did this come about, this turnaround in policy?
Watergate. Richard Helms is going by the old CIA tradition, which is that, if necessary, the director will openly lie.
CIA's involvement in covert action.
In the post-Watergate atmosphere, even secret services aren't allowed secrets. William Colby, the new director of the CIA, had told a congressional committee in strictest confidence how the agency had indeed spent $8 million financing opposition to Allende. So enraged was Congressman Michael Harrington that he leaked Colby's secret testimony to the press and exposed the earlier deception.
I went in prepared to accept the ground rules of secrecy, but it was obviously at such pronounced variance with what both I had believed and what the American public had been told. I think it was very important, and still do, that in some fashion, preferably without the distraction of how it was released, to get the American public to understand what we did in the context of a country like Chile, not in the mid-50s, but in the early 1970s.
The secret information given to Harrington showed that the CIA's so-called Dirty Tricks Department was active in Chile. First, in a bid to stop the endorsement of Allende, who had scraped home so narrowly, the CIA earmarked $350,000 to bribe Chilean congressmen. That plan failed, and Allende became president. The CIA then set about undermining him. They helped finance demonstrations by middle-class women who beat pots and pans outside Allende's house each day. They also financed more sinister groups like the right-wing terrorist group Fatherland and Freedom Party, which blew up bridges and radio transmitters and caused riots. But the catalyst that finally paved the way for Allende's overthrow was the one used successfully by the CIA in Guyana 10 years before, a prolonged strike, this time by Chilean lorry owners. 2,700 miles long, Chile is totally dependent on road transport. The result was chaos. The strikers stayed out for 6 weeks, subsidized secretly by the CIA. The chaos of the CIA-backed strike gave Allende's opponents in the Chilean armed forces the excuse they needed. The presidential palace was bombed. Allende died inside it, and 15,000 socialists were murdered by the military regime, now one of the most repressive in Latin America.
I think it was a mistake for us because it was a terrible embarrassment for it to come out. I think we pay for it in shame and in loss of dignity.
Who, in fact, ran the...
Dr. Kissinger ran the Chile operation, very much like a desk officer. He's that way. He likes to do things himself.
Now, Martin, the main point here being that Thomas Braden, director deputy director of the CIA says in that clip is actually that he personally knew that Kissinger ran the entire operation from his desk in the State Department, the overthrow of Allende and the installation of General Pinochet in Chile. I mean, this led to something like 30, 40,000 people disappeared in that country over a decade.
Yeah, well, it's even worse in Argentina. And, of course, they were behind all of the military governments in Latin America in that era who killed hundreds of thousands of people in the most horrible circumstances. And that's where that's your tax dollars at work, folks.
OK, we'll have to do astroturfing next week again, I'm afraid. But since it's the beginning of a new school year, a chillingly accurate 200-year-old letter predicts World War III, a final battle against Islam. This is in the Daily Express. The Daily Mail have covered it too. A letter written by American Civil War captain predicted both world wars and a battle with Islam. Albert Pike, who was captain for the US Army during the American Civil War, is said to have written a doctrine to an Italian politician outlining plans for three world wars. The letter plots how and why the First and Second World Wars broke out in the 1900s, provides an even more chilling prophecy over a third and final battle. The Third World War, according to Mr. Pike, will be fought against the West and leaders of the Islamic War. He said it would be the most bloody turmoil. Document revealed by several newspapers, The Mail and The Star, etc., is revealed in various books. Reportedly sent by Pike, a Freemason, to Italian politician Giuseppe Mazzini, and was dated August 15th, 1871.
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen next week, so plotting a World War 200 years in the future is pretty, you know, I don't really give it that much credence, Tony, I have to say.
Mr. Pike warned the Third World War would be the most bloody turmoil. We shall unleash the nihilists and the atheists. We shall provoke a formidable social cataclysm, which in all its horror will show clearly to the nations the effect of absolute atheism. Origin of savagery in the most bloody turmoil. Now, I mean, whether this is true aside, this does seem to be the sort of thing that's brewing up, a kind of religious war between Zionists and Islam.
Don't have to be a prophet to predict that we may end up having a third world war. And you don't need to read stuff written 200 years ago on spec. It's all staring
you in
the face,
folks. I'll put a link into the Daily Mail and the Daily Express articles on that anyway, because it's, I think, quite fascinating. Time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up for the next 2 hours, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Kamal. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Bishopston and Ashley Down, Tom Brook.
Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips, in studio with journalist and activist editor of Occupy.com, Michael Leventon, as my co-host today. Mickey Huff will return next week. In today's show, we interview longtime peace activist Brian Wilson regarding a new film about himself and the peace movement in the United States. Also joining us will be Bo Boudart, producer and director of the film. The film is Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson. We hope you stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Peter Phillips, in studio with journalist and activist Michael Leventon as my co-host today. Mickey Huff will return next week. In today's show, we interview longtime peace activist Brian Wilson regarding a new film about himself and the peace movement in the United States. Joining us also will be Bo Boudart, producer and director of the film. The film is Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson. S. Brian Wilson is a Vietnam veteran,
peace activist and attorney at law. He served in the U.S. Air Force from 1966 to 1970 and came out of that war as a captain, but also became very active in the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. He completed law school at the American University of Washington, D.C., and he, as a trained lawyer, he has documented U.S. policy in nearly two dozen countries around the world. These policies challenge, he claims, violate U.S. constitutional and international laws prohibiting war and aggression and crime. Also with us is Bo Boudart. He's a producer of wildlife, ecology, and cultural human rights films. He's won numerous awards. His productions have covered all over the world, Indonesia, Philippine Islands, South America. And he's been aired on Discovery Channel, public television, Canadian broadcast. And you've helped put this film together. Bo is a graduate from film studies at San Francisco State University in 1990. So welcome, Brian and Bo.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian, let's start with you. Let's go back historically. That's how the film begins, was you going to Vietnam and things that happened to you there, and how you transitioned from certainly what was described at the time as pro-America policies into something really solidly questioning.
Well, you know, I was a very conservative young man, like everybody else that I knew of growing up in Western New York State. But when I was drafted in 1966, I was in my fourth semester of law school. I was still very much for the war. I was sorry that I was losing my school deferment because I didn't really want to be a soldier. In those days, that was called a chicken hawk. You were a hawk in the war, but a chicken didn't want to fight in the war. But I wound up enlisting in the Air Force rather than going in the Army, and that led to my being sent to Vietnam in 1969. As a first lieutenant in a security unit checking air bases, and wound up getting a kind of an extra duty assessing the success or failure of bombing missions, which is when I discovered that the bombing missions were targeting inhabited villages where everybody was pretty much wiped out in a few minutes of each airstrike. And most of the victims were young children and mothers. And I was shocked and attempted to bring it to the attention of higher officers that these couldn't possibly be justified bombings, and found out, of course, that it was intentional policies just to get body counts. And that's what ended my loyalty to the myth of the United States. I've been on a different track ever since. That was in the spring of 1969.
Highlighted by you being on a different track on September 1st, 1987, where you were run over by a munitions train at the Concord Naval Weapons Station and lost both of your legs. That was a tragic event and put you, of course, in the front lines internationally of involvement in peace actions, has taken you all over the world. So, Bo, You put together a film about Brian that traces not only his actions, but kind of the peace movement in the United States. What was your motivation for putting this film together?
After starting to present Brian Wilson's story, I realized that there were many other veterans who were experiencing, having realizations as Brian did, that they were fighting in wars that were not wars for defense, but wars of aggression. So we really wanted to get those voices. And so fortunately, some of them knew of Brian. And so it wasn't too difficult to get perspectives from certainly Camilo Mejia, who was born and raised in Nicaragua, but then went through the GI Bill and was sent to Iraq. And so participated in that war and then came back to the U.S. and went to AWOL and tried to get himself surrendered eventually to the Army and was court-martialed. But that was one story. But there's several other stories of veterans who worked with Brian that we also present along with him, at least two other veterans, Duncan Murphy and Charlie Litke. And with the archive footage from these events that they participated in, it contributed to really a whole history of their experiences in the Vietnam War, and then the experiences that the younger veterans had had in the Iraq War. And so building upon that, we have their perspective, but we also involve peace activists that have become very recognized voices in the United States, including people like Medea Benjamin, David Hartsoe, and many others. We weaved their stories and their perspectives of how they've been trying to speak out against the policies of the U.S. so far as involvement in these illegal wars.
This is Michael Levitin jumping in here. Brian, talking about today's Central American and Latin American policies and United States involvement in sort of helping shape behind the scenes what's going on there, I mean, your involvement with Nicaragua, obviously going back decades, and the Central American wars and the Contras, how do you see these decades later, since your work down there, kind of either changing or staying the same? I mean, with Hillary Clinton now, you know, looking to become our president, and she played quite a role in the Honduras coup and sort of really what is seen as a pretty undemocratic moment that she was pretty central in green lighting from the U.S. side, and of course the U.S. with Venezuela, with Bolivia, with Ecuador, with any of the leaders that have been part of the leftward shift over the last 10, 15 years, Washington continues to play a pretty exercising role. How do you see this change?
I think you just said the U.S. policy has really not changed. The U.S. is used to being in charge, and really an empire like the U.S. cannot tolerate people power anywhere, whether it's internal or external. So I think the U.S. can never be trusted to honor any country's sovereignty. And I know the U.S. has been frustrated with the leftward movement in the last 15 years, but they're always on it. You know, they have a CIA station in every embassy. They're watching all the movements in every country that might be threatening business interests or the status quo. So, I mean, it's true that nothing really has changed in the U.S. policy. In my view, it's basically hasn't changed since we stole the land from the Indian. We basically have a cultural DNA of imperialism, and we're used to being in charge, and that means controlling people and really watching out for people moving both in the United States and elsewhere. Sorry to say that that's why we need a radical peace movement, and probably a good reason why we don't have a draft, because they learned they have a draft, it will ignite lots of vigorous dissent. So I've never been a fan of the volunteer army, needless to say. But they know not to institute a real conscription, because people will not accept every family having to face the prospect of one of their children going off to wars, and it becomes a mercenary army, and people know that. So U.S. policy doesn't change, in my view, basically does not change from one generation to another, certainly not for very long. If there is a change, it's not permanent, because we have to be in charge to maintain our hubris and our way of life and our profits for the corporation, which are based on exploiting other people.
I wanted to kind of expand on that a bit. Bo, in the film, towards the end, you lay out that there's a million U.S. soldiers stationed all over the world in just about every country. And the motivation for this global military empire is certainly, we use the term imperialism and we use the term profits for corporations. Is it more than that? And really, what is the engineering process? Who's in charge that makes all this happen?
Really, the policies come through either the corporate leadership or the military-industrial complex combined with the CIA and the military itself to essentially have and maintain dominance and presence, if you will, in over 175 countries with just that, their presence. And that essentially creates a complete impasse to the ability of the local people to exercise their own sovereignty, if you will, because anything that they do will be construed or evaluated by the Americans that are present. And so, ergo, they they want to be in charge, and that's the policy that's been maintained till today, and it's costing more than $700 billion a year to maintain that, and of course is creating millions of veterans, at least those who are seeing action, who come back and need to address their PTSD or their injuries, and this is costing upwards of more than $1 trillion to the U.S. taxpayers. And so this is really how it's really gone out of control, and that the film itself is to call attention by Americans to realize that the price that it's being paid to Americans is one that they are not being served so far as their own social and economic needs. The lion's share, more than 55% of the budget, is being spent to uphold and perpetuate its military.
The film is Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson. We're talking both with Brian and Bo Budar, the producer and director of the film. We're going to now take a short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and my co-host today is Michael Leventon, editor of Occupy.com. We are interviewing S. Brian Wilson about the new film that he's featured in, Paying the Price for Peace. And we also have on the line the director and producer of the film, Bo Budar. The film is going to be featured at the Grand Lake Theater on Tuesday, September 6th at 7 p.m. with a second screening at 9:30. That's in Oakland, and we're very excited about that happening next week, and I highly recommend this film. I've had a chance to view it this week. It's really incredible.
Please mention that there'll be another screening on September 7th at the Unitarian Church in San Francisco.
Yes, and we will summarize that, of course, at the end of the show, but the film is very much worth seeing, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to KPFA are going to want to take the opportunity to go to the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on September 6th at 7 p.m. or the 9 p.m. screening, and or on Wednesday, September 7th at the First Unitarian Church in San Francisco. So, Brian Wilson, we're going to get back to talking about some of the featured things in the film, and it's really a documentation of various techniques of resistance to the U.S. military empire and in our interventions in countries all over the world. One of those interventions was, of course, under the Reagan administration, interventions in Nicaragua and other parts of Latin America. So talk about your history there. Talk about the fast that you did in Washington, D.C.
In 1986, in January, I took my first trip to Nicaragua to see what was happening with Reagan's policies of funding and arming the Contras, terrorists that were being trained by the CIA to overthrow the revolutionary government of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas. I was there 2 months. In the very first week, I was in Esteli up in the mountains, and the Contras attacked 3 farming cooperatives very near Esteli, and there were 11 campesinos killed, and I saw 5 or 6 of those coming into the Esteli cemetery in caskets, and I just was, again, kind of shaken viscerally to realize that this is kind of what we do all the time. We destroy any efforts by people to maintain some sense of justice or sovereignty for themselves. And from that experience, I came back to the U.S. and was meeting a lot of other veterans by that time who were also visiting Central America, veterans, mostly Vietnam veterans, but not exclusively, some Korean veterans and even World War II veterans. And 4 of us veterans decided late spring, early summer, that we were going to go on an open-ended, water-only fast on the front steps of the U.S. Capitol building as a different kind of a protest You could say it was kind of a silent protest, although we did sit there and talk to ourselves. Initially, there wasn't too many other people around. But we had a big banner that said, Veterans Fast for Life, No More War in Central America. And we sat there probably for a couple of weeks before very many people even noticed us, except for the Capitol Police, who were actually friendly. They didn't see us as any threat. We were just sitting there drinking water. And then after maybe 4 or 5 weeks, we started getting a lot of attention. A lot more people were showing up at these steps. And the sixth week, Phil Donahue had us on the Donahue Show. And that really dramatically increased the number of people who were aware of our fast. We had had a bunch of senators and congressmen coming out to see us after about the fourth or fifth week. So we were having some conversations with senators and congresspeople. But after the Donahue Show, we were getting, really, I think, started getting thousands of letters every day and hundreds of people on the steps, sometimes as many as 1,000. And we were getting evidence from around the country, various organizations and individuals who were doing a variety of activities publicly in solidarity with our fast. And one of our members, one of the four of us, was getting very sick, George Mizo, a Vietnam veteran. And so we were under doctors monitoring the whole time of the fast. And the doctor said that George was a few days from death if he didn't eat anything. And we were still kind of committed to an open-ended fast unless we really saw evidence of a significant uprising among the people against Reagan's policies in Central America. But by the 46th day, we had cataloged about 500 actions that we clearly knew were in solidarity with our fast in opposition to Reagan's policies. And on the 47th day, we agreed that we would stop the fast, motivated by making sure that George probably wasn't going to die. But we had enough evidence to say that there was a significant response to the fast. So we ended the fast on the 47th day. Now, what we did not know at that time was that the FBI had somehow been alerted that we were, I don't understand quite the nature of the FBI concern at that time, but they decided that we were domestic terrorist suspects. We didn't know that then, but we knew it a year later, because after I was hit by the train a year later, the September 1st, 87, beginning of my block on the tracks with two other veterans was exactly 1 year after we started the fast in 86, we discovered that one of the reasons the train did not stop on September 1st, and that actually the train crew was ordered to not stop, we found out in depositions, was because the FBI had identified us as domestic terrorist suspects under the sabotage statute. I do not know what the evidence they were using. I guess they fabricated notions that we were going to hijack the train or something. I don't know. But that investigation began while we were fasting on the Capitol steps the year before.
Brian, can I just ask for listeners, did the person responsible or the small team responsible for making the decision to keep that train running and to not stop, were they held accountable?
They were not held accountable. And interestingly enough, the Navy did an investigation of what happened on September 1st. And the investigation was actually quite good. And the investigation, which was done by a Navy commander, he recommended, he said that the Navy crew could see us for 650 feet and never tried to stop. He did recommend some penalties and punishments for the train crew, two levels of supervisors above them, and the commander of the base. They weren't charged with crimes, certainly not by the Navy, but the Navy report did identify them as having been complicit in doing something that was wrong. But there was no follow-through on actual punishments. So nobody was really held to account in any administrative or legal way except in the Navy, the original Navy report, which I still have a copy of because it's quite remarkable.
My understanding is you were sued for causing them trauma.
Yeah, they sued me first for causing them trauma. Bizarre.
Brian, the day you were there on the tracks, you were trying to stop munition trains from going to the port by the Concord Naval Weapons Station to load weapons that were going to Latin America. Is that correct?
Correct.
And at that time, we knew that the support for the Contras and the undermining of the Nicaragua Revolution was ongoing. A lot of that became exposed through the Iran-Contra hearings and that. But that day, you had alerted the military that you were going to be on the tracks, and the train accelerated towards you. What was your experience as that was happening?
I have to tell you that I have no memory of what happened that day. I have a memory of going out there that morning, but I kind of lose my memory maybe half an hour or 45 minutes before I actually was struck. There were 45 of my friends there, which there were plenty of eyewitnesses, and there were two other veterans with me on the tracks. I have no memory of what was going through my mind before that train struck me. Now, the photographs show, I mean, there were five photographers there and a videographer, all to document our arrests. I mean, that's traditionally what had happened at the Concord Naval Weapons Station. They arrested people who were obstructing the movement of the trains. Some of those demonstrations went back to the late 60s, actually. So that was not an unusual event at that site. But one of the other two veterans who was blocking with me that day, many years later, asked me what I remembered my last words, and I said, no, I have no memory. And he said, he tapped me on the shoulder as the train was coming towards us, seemingly at a faster clip than we'd ever seen it before. And he said, what are your feelings? And he said, I said, I'm anxious. So all I know is what one of the other veterans said, that I said I was anxious. But the photographs show that my right arm was starting to brace on the right rail, as if to launch me off to the right, out of the path of the train, but it was obviously too late. The other two veterans who were blocking with me, one jumped to the left, and one jumped straight up and grabbed the railing over the cowcatcher as the train plowed through us, and then he jumped off, and he was the first person to my body that went completely under the train. Pretty amazing that I even survived, of course.
That is truly amazing, and we have all been very glad that you did after that tragic event. We're going to continue with our interview with Brian Wilson and Bo Budar after this short musical break. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips, and my co-host today is Michael Leventon. He's editor of Occupy.com. We're interviewing S. Brian Wilson about his movie that's about him, Paying the Price for Peace, and the producer of that film, Bo Budar. Bo, let's go back to you. The film has numerous archive footage about, particularly about the protests in Concord and many, many others, but there's a big crowd that happened after Brian was run over by the train. Thousands of people showed up. I am proud to say that I was one of them. And talk us about putting the film together and how you acquired all of that footage.
Brian kept a very good library of the sources of that footage and turned over all he had for me to review. And some of this footage is kind of degraded a bit because in those days they were recorded on VHS tapes. And wherever I could go back to the source of who took the footage to see if they had transferred it to, you know, either DVD or just to another format. So we did the best we could, but I have to say that without the help of especially one person, Bob Spitzer, who really was responsible for not only the footage at the train tracks and that event, but also took footage of the vets' fast for life in D.C., as well as went and documented footage in Nicaragua when Brian was there. But there were others as well that contributed footage or that we found sources of. And, you know, some of it was really doing some research to archives in Washington, D.C., where we got some excellent footage of some of the Charlie Lippe scenes as a chaplain in Vietnam, as well as just footage of what was happening on the ground. So apart from that, I think we were really fortunate to also get footage from other associated friends of the film that documented one of the early Vietnam vet protests in D.C. in 1971, known as the Dewey Canyon 3. That shows the more vets that were throwing their medals of honor in protest of the war. And that also included one from Charlie Lippe, who is one of the main vets that basically did a lot of work with Brian. But this is all part of the process and recounting all these scenes and these events as best we could, you know, from a documentary approach. But, you know, it also involves getting a lot of new footage with individuals like Dan Ellsberg, you know, Colonel Ann Wright, and Alice Walker, Ron Kovic, David Swanson, Bruce Gagnon, a lot of good footage with Martin Sheen and Camila Mejia, among others. And I think without their cooperation, support, and I have to say, they really made my work a lot easier because, of course, they were all very much close to Brian, and this all made for a very positive experience. And
can I ask to bring things back from the actual film into something really contemporary? I don't know if you guys are aware, you probably are. At this point, the big flap in the Bay Area over the last week has been the big 49ers quarterback who refused to stand for the Star Spangled Banner at a preseason game. It has become a national issue. He's doing this for racial justice reasons, for whether it's Black Lives Matter or simply for police brutality. But it's this pretty initial effort, and I don't think anybody's really seen it, confronting patriotism and our notions of it in America. And it was on the New York Times, a front page story. You know, is it time? Are Americans ready to reevaluate and think about what this form of patriotism is, that if you do not stand, if you don't wear the flag on your lapel as a politician, if you don't recite these words, hundreds of year old words, that you're somehow really un-American? And the veterans have actually come out in favor of this quarterback, Colin Kaepernick. Veterans have, you know, gone on Twitter and say we support him. So, you know, Brian, these many years that you've been really clearly on one side of it, of the issue, and obviously patriotism is something that drew you into Vietnam initially, and then you obviously rejected it and have spent years going the other way. How do you see this and this new conversation? Is it time? Are Americans even, are they ready to discuss this?
I never know what the U.S. Americans are ready for, but I'm thrilled, of course, that this athlete, known by lots of people, has said that he's not going to participate in this phony baloney patriotism. And I just hope a lot more athletes take advantage of their notoriety and follow suit. I'm not holding my breath, but I mean, I never know what history's going to produce. And you never know when there's a spark that will provoke far more honesty about who we really are as a people and what we really do to ourselves as well as to people elsewhere. So I'm really thrilled. I was an athlete myself when I was younger, and I know most athletes are very spoiled and don't want to jeopardize their position and stature with the fans and ownership of their salaries. But I really just thrilled at least one did that, and I'm hoping more will do it.
It goes back to, you know, even the Iraq War. Anybody in America who does not profess a really clear, this full-throated pro-American, everything good about, you know, red-blooded America, and in a warmongering sense, too. I mean, we went to Iraq sort of for that reason. Can you see that changing? I mean, America, just because we've been for 100 years since, you know, really the Philippine-American War, seems like our first time really colonially colonizing and going abroad in this imperialist way. But isn't there a way? Do you see that as something that can change with a new generation? It might not have changed in your generation and since the 60s and Vietnam, but this sense of patriotism that you don't have, you can be a patriot. You know, Bernie Sanders is a patriot just because he's calling for the arrest and jailing of Wall Street bankers who took down the economy. I mean, there are patriots who the establishment determines to call non-patriotic. But do you see this possibly changing?
Well, I always see the possibility of change. I mean, the conditions within our own country are so deplorable socially and economically and politically. And we see the rise of disgruntlement in both the support for Trump and the support for Sanders, who did not represent the major party interests, were not supported by the major party players. Those candidates were popular because people are unhappy, maybe for different reasons, but there's a lot of despair and, you could say, psychological depression or disappointment or just plain rage that neither political party, such as they are addressing the issues of the people. So I think all throughout history, recorded history, people will only stay on bended knee for so long before they rise up. And so maybe, you know, with the Occupy movement in 2011 and the Black Lives Matter and the Rise Up groups around the country, who knows, maybe there's something that's ready to kind of emerge in a coalescence of organized anger that's going to bring the system down. I mean, I hope that really does happen.
There's so many people in the film, Scott Olson, Cindy Sheehan, Colonel Ann Wright, Medea Benjamin, of course, David Swanson, David Hartsoe, Alice Walker, Daniel Ellsberg, Martin Sheen, and many, many more. In my mind, these people are total patriots. That is, the American flag belongs to all of us. We have the right to wave that flag in terms of peace and patriotism. We can pledge allegiance to the Constitution and the flag that represents that. But, I mean, that's the idea of who we are as a people. So we don't have to be alienated from the flag. We don't have to be alienated from the pledge. If we put it in the context of our Constitution, that's ours. And every one of these people strongly supports the United States and challenges the direction that it's been manipulated by power elites in the country and the military complex. So when it comes to patriotism, I certainly think any athlete sitting down is on the right track.
I'd also like to say, this is Bo Boudarian, especially on behalf of those patriots, although they are also called whistleblowers, and that Chelsea Manning is paying a heavy price for having divulged not only the collateral murder video, but other documents, and which is completely against principles of doing something in defense of getting information to the citizens that they should know about, and that includes Ed Snowden and his work. And I think we do examine Manning's role pretty well in the film, but I think this is something that Dan Ellsberg states, is that these are people that essentially are necessary if you're going to have a healthy or something that you could call a functioning democracy. And without that, we are on the road to suppress the truth. And I think that this is one of the messages of our film really addresses, is that these people are paying a heavy price for their exposure of the truth, but they are just a few. We also want to get the word out that you don't have to necessarily do something as radical as Brian did, but in order to really have an impact on policies of the U.S. and addressing their civil rights. So I just wanted to include that.
I was very pleased that you had support for whistleblowers in the film, and that's certainly a part of that. You also talk about Occupied and the impact that that had. And my co-host today, of course, Michael Levinson, is very much part of that Occupy movement. And you were pleased to announce that the Occupy, it kind of upset the power structure. You know, there was a very big questioning. So, Michael, certainly that's an outcome. And we all know now the 1% versus 99%, that's just part of our culture.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting also, Brian, you mentioned your 47 days, the fast, and gosh, the encampments of Occupy didn't last a whole lot longer than that. I think 2 months was probably the average. So when you say people started to tune in to you and your fast around week four, I think it happened earlier with Occupy, but it's interesting that it does take the public weeks to tune in, to actually open their eyes to see that something's going on. And then, it sort of hits a kind of a climax or somewhere around week four or five. But I guess the question with your nonviolent history and looking at Occupy, which was fundamentally a nonviolent, it was completely it was sitting in parks and making food in parks and discussing in parks and protesting and marching, but entirely nonviolent. You know, I think the whole movement in America, the young movement, the millennial generation, everybody, people now supporting Bill McKibben and the divestment movement and going out and blocking coal trains, the next evolution of what you were doing, now trying to stop fossil fuel shipments going across the country. But what, I guess people are looking for a strategy to obviously stay nonviolent and stay pacific in that way, and yet what to do to reach beyond those few weeks of protest and to sustain it and to waken people so that the public is awoken and the public is angry and fired up the way that Occupy did across the nation, across the world, but then to sustain that and to somehow convert that kind of in the way that Bernie Sanders is trying to convert his energy from his campaign now into something longer term. But the protest movement, would you have kind of words of advice or what you would say to younger people who simply can't go more than about 4 or 5 or 6 weeks. Your life demand something changes, and yet what do you think about the evolution of that form of protest?
Well, I think it's still too early to say just exactly how it's going to manifest. I know up in the Pacific Northwest, there are people meeting in towns, Seattle down to Portland, constantly organizing the next blockade of coal trains or tar sands trains, and they're working a lot with the indigenous because the indigenous lands are very much in the way of these, both the train lines and the water routes. And so I think we're on the cusp of something. I mean, we know that the Mother Earth has a fever, and the fevers respond to infections, and, you know, we're the infection kind of on the planet, a species burning carbon. And I think that that issue alone is going to bring more and more people together around the connection between the military, corrupt politics of business as usual, basically making a lot of money and burning carbon and mining it, and lifestyles. I think it has the potential for being an incredible revolutionary time. And I think Occupy, even though the camps were shut down in November of 2011, I think that Occupy was a seed that is still sprouting. And with the conditions in the country, just the objective conditions materially, economically, of people all over the country being increasingly worsened, at some point people will have a massive Occupy, because Occupy was not organized, systematically organized. It was very spontaneous. I think there were 2,700 camps in the U.S., and there were a number around the world. And they all started in October, maybe late September, early October. Most of them were shut down by November 15th. But that provoked something. I mean, I think that is not dead. It's kind of historically in some kind of a reflective mood, but the conditions have gotten worse. And I do think in the long run, human beings respond to their conditions. They will not accept passively compliance and obedience to the system. And I just hope that there's enough models of nonviolent struggle and nonviolent resistance. I mean, I've been a tax refuser since 1983. I just haven't been able to pay money to the government, and I've had to figure out a way to do that. I basically became self-employed and didn't want to own any property that could be seized. But I just think that we're on the cusp of something. Black Lives Matter and Rise Up, which is our organization, and the 350 movement, I think that there's something that's about ready to coalesce. That's my upbeat perspective. And I don't know how it's going to look. And I think it's going to be pretty painful, but it's also going to be pretty hopeful or pretty encouraging that we will not be stuck with this oligarchic, repressive structure that has become more entrenched every year. And I think the idea of looking to a president election some kind of a solution is a big mistake. I mean, the president basically is a spokesperson for the cabal to maintain the plundering American empire. We really need a serious grassroots movement everywhere that's going to be obstructing business as usual in the streets.
That's the voice of Brian Wilson, who is the subject of the new film, Paying the Price for Peace, and will be airing Tuesday at 7 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland. And we're very excited about that. It'll be at the Unitarian Universalist Church the following Wednesday. I'm Peter Phillips with Michael Leventon, and we'll return after the short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Peter Phillips. My co-host today is Michael Leventon, editor of Occupy.com. And we've been interviewing Brian Wilson, who is the subject of the new film, Paying the Price for Peace, that was put together by director and producer Bo Budar. And Brian, we'll come back, and I think the film ends up very interestingly because it talks about the merger of movements. And I see from the film that you travel a lot by bicycle. And that is the lifestyle you have chosen as part of being a peace activist. So you're talking that there's environmental concerns with the world. There's certainly massive pollution concerns with the military. So talk about a little bit about that in the context of what people can do individually. And I go back to your peace action teams as a model. But where do we stand today? How can people become involved on a local basis?
Well, there's a lot of there's a lot of things going on locally all over the place. I mean, really, there really is a kind of a brewing. I think primarily because of the climate catastrophe we're all facing, which is based on our lifestyle of burning carbon, which the military not just is the biggest burner of carbon, the biggest producer of carbon molecules, but it's also the necessary force to assure that we can maintain our life of burning carbon. And it's kind of a big ironic spiral of the trap that we're all in. And that's why I think more and more people are beginning to sense, without necessarily being conscious of the strategy, that the system itself, the political economy, capitalism, oligarchic structure, corporatism, is kind of strangling us, and we're at the same time dependent upon the production of those things that we consume, that we call modern lifestyles. And so I think there's a lot of people, a lot of places that are in a different mind space than they were even a few years ago. And like in Portland, there's a lot of potlucks going on all the time with discussions about what people are going to be doing. Now, I have been interested in ecological issues since I was farming in the 1970s. and I have really been interested in reducing my dependence upon carbon. So I think of simplicity. I think of cycling rather than driving. When I was farming, I was learning draft horses from the Amish rather than having tractors. I do take trains. I don't fly. I do take Amtrak, and take Amtrak quite often, actually. And I garden and do permaculture gardening. My wife does most of that. But I think that the future is local and not national. I think, you know, the globe is a product of thousands of local communities are doing. And also, I'm a big fan or big supporter of people choosing not to pay taxes or living below the taxable level, which means looking at your lifestyle and simplifying things. I think that the massive consumption of those of us in the West does provide the political energy to maintain the system. I think that's kind of a structural issue we all have to face because we're all caught up in it. We live in a way that demands consumption of resources. Those resources have to be basically stolen from the earth, and most of them are stolen from other countries, not from our own country. We've done plenty of that in our own country. Now we have to go elsewhere to continue exploiting resources to keep up with our demand for consumption. So I think part of the revolutionary awareness is to realize that we're all somehow complicit, and therefore we're all part of the problem, I mean all part of the solution, as we reorganize locally around how to reduce our dependence upon external inputs from corporations, more on local food and local conversations where we really do have a capacity for making big impacts, and that becomes contagious and expands beyond our local communities to other communities, and then you have basically you have a movement. And I think 350 is part of that, Black Lives Matter. I mean, in Portland, which has a reputation for being a progressive town, the police there are pretty terrible. They're no better than police most elsewhere. So we have all these issues. We have, if you go through parts of the Midwest, you'll see, even in Cleveland, Ohio, you'll see parts of the city that looks like it's a war zone. I mean, right now, right in this moment. Milwaukee, St. Louis, and even in Portland, East Portland. So we have the conditions that are really the material economic conditions worsening, while we have a few people making a lot of money and are very comfortable. And so we know, just observing this dynamic, that something's going to give.
But, Brian, so, yeah, on that subject of something's got to give, the final, it looks like we're time to wrap up and probably just have one final comment, but this idea of kind of a revolutionary mindset and revolutionary politics, it's got to square somehow with the fact that things have to go on the next day. And, you know, when you talk about having a sit-in or something that gets the politicians, get people to wake up and change policy, but people really fundamentally don't want a full breakdown and starting from scratch. That's not likely going to happen. And if it did have to happen, it would be really horrendous on many fronts. How do you, a final kind of word of, you know, a reformist revolutionary kind of approach, you know, yours sounds like that with the ecological approach and gardening and personally taking responsibility. But do you have hope that, do you see a moderate way that we can move toward radical change?
I don't know if I see a moderate way. I mean, I don't even know how to predict what's going to happen. I know something's going to happen because the Earth is correcting us. Whatever we do or don't do, the Earth is in the process of correcting our species that burns carbon. In the meantime, it seems to me that it's an great opportunity to learn, rediscover what local cooperation means, and that includes obstruction of business as usual. You remember Martin Luther King had this plan for Resurrection City in 1968. He wanted 500,000 people to come to the mall until the funding for the war stopped and funding was redirected to domestic needs. And his plan included lots of people coming to reinforce and replace people who were there initially. So that was a continuous occupation. To me, that's a great model. You have to obstruct business as usual, both by withdrawing support from it and interfering with its continued functioning as usual. And things like Rise Up are doing that. And I just don't know where it's going. I'm not a prophet. I just know that something is going to give, and I'm hoping that more and more people are going to be part of this uprising. And it probably takes many forms and shapes, including tax refusal, simplification of life, obstructing business as usual, obstructing tracks in the Pacific Northwest, which up to now have just been three-day obstructions. They're talking about permanent obstructions, where they have groups of people ready to replace the people that were there for 3 days. And so that continues. I mean, who knows what the creative human mind, when it's upset and is not willing to accept business as usual, where it's going to lead. It could be terrible, and it could be incredibly awake, and it could be a combination of both.
Well, Brian Wilson, thank you so much for joining the Project Censored Show today. Thank you, Bo Bidar, for producing the film, Paying the Price for Peace. It's the story of S. Brian Wilson. We'll be airing at the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland on Tuesday, September 6th at 7 p.m., with a second screening at 9:30 p.m., sponsored by KPFA. That's 3200 Grand Avenue in Oakland. And then on Wednesday, September 7th, the First Unitarian Universalist Society in San Francisco will be showing the film at 7 p.m. at 1187 Franklin Street in San Francisco. So we really look forward to that. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
And thank you also to Michael Leventon today as my co-host. I sincerely appreciate your involvement here. The 9/11 Film Festival is going to be held again this year at the Grand Lake Theater on September 8th from 1 to 10 p.m. It's entitled The Sacred Cow. TSA Lies, NSA, Deep State, Empire, Neocons, FBI, all of that involved. Numbers of good films, Incontrovertible, will be shown, which we featured here on our Project Censored Show. 9/11, Decade of Deceit, Demolition of Truth. Graham McQueen will be there speaking about anthrax deception. Myself and Mickey will be speaking in the middle of the afternoon. Everyone is welcome to participate. Bonnie Faulkner is be there as the overall host for the day. So that's the 9/11 Film Festival, Grand Lake Theater, Thursday, September 8th, from 1 to 10 p.m.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You are tuned to the Project Censored Show. Special thanks today to our producer Anthony Fest and our engineer Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time. Up next, Tara Verde.
Political ties, habitualized, alibi, skies, another guy's democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing all the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, those are capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out the reach, all potential being at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love, we live our brother, they don't have to be one. The people together can overthrow the
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, time of useful consciousness. The Dublin interview with Professor Kevin Anderson. Kevin Anderson is Professor of Energy and Climate Change in the School of Mechanical Aerospace and Civil Engineering at the University of Manchester. He's also Deputy Director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research and active in academia, with recent publications in Royal Society journals and in Nature. Before having this extraordinary academic career, Kevin Anderson was a mechanical engineer and worked on oil rigs and gas platforms. His dual background in engineering and academia make him a sought-after consultant. Anderson reported on aviation-related emissions to the European Union Parliament, advised the Prime Minister's Office on carbon trading, and has contributed to the development of the UK's Climate Change Act. Sadly, the governing bodies do not always act on his advice, and Anderson has become concerned that these institutions will not be able to act quickly enough to avert a climate catastrophe. With his colleague Alice Bowes, Kevin's work on carbon budgets has been pivotal in revealing the widening gulf between political rhetoric on climate change and the reality of rapidly escalating emissions. Today, the most often quoted tools to bring down carbon emissions are carbon trading, carbon taxes, and NASA's James Hansen's worldwide carbon fee, charged at a domestic mine or port of entry. DEFRA is the UK government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. They are responsible for environmental protection. Kevin Anderson proposed a different system of rationing that was considered by DEFRA as ahead of its time when they looked at it in 2008. Although some argued that it was based on a successful system of rationing widely used in Europe and the US during World War II. In this conclusion of the interview of Kevin Anderson by John Gibbons in Dublin, Ireland, in March 2016, Gibbons begins by asking how such a system of rationing would work.
Kevin, in terms of how we manage the descent, whether it's the energy descent or the demand descent, would you have a view as to how we can do this in a way that is fair, equitable and achievable? Are we talking then about carbon rationing on a per-person basis?
I think that's one to seriously consider. I and some colleagues did some work on this quite a few years ago. David Miliband was the minister at DEFRA, and he was in fact the architect in the UK for the Climate Change Act in 2008. And he liked the idea of the personal carbon allowance that myself and some colleagues were working on, liked it sufficiently well that he had passed it on to the economists in DEFRA to analyse, and they came back, and their broad conclusion was that it was a policy ahead of its time. Well, OK, that was 2008, we're now in 2016, perhaps we should be revisiting the idea of some sort of personal carbon allowance. One of the benefits of that sort of approach, if you're trying to bring very rapid reductions in our emissions that are necessary for our 2 degrees C framing, is that it helps with the equity issues. It means that poorer people in our society would have, at least initially, would have plenty of carbon allowance to allow them to carry on their lives as they are. But better still, it means those people like myself, who would probably end up using more energy than my carbon allowance would permit, I would have to buy carbon effectively from them on the carbon market, which means I would be providing them with additional income. They would then spend some of that income on improving the amount of heating in their homes. That means their carbon emissions go up a little bit. But within the set carbon allowance, that means mine have to come down. And that means the wealthy people, unlike with a carbon tax, they have to drive the innovation process. And we know that the early adopters in society are the wealthy. the early adopters of new technology. It's the wealthy in our society that initially drive innovation. The great thing about a carbon allowance would drive that innovation process and protect people who are in positions of poverty and suffering already with high fuel prices. So I think there are some very strong merits to a personal carbon allowance. So we think if you're serious about large reductions in emissions, myself and a few colleagues felt this was a very serious instrument to consider and had lots of merits over and above a carbon tax. Now, again, I think you have to go from country to country. Would it be appropriate in some countries and perhaps not in others? And there are certain issues you'd have to consider. But whatever instruments we talk about now for climate change, we are talking about very rapid reductions in carbon dioxide emissions.
If we think back to the last use of ration cards, obviously during the Second World War in Britain, a side effect of that was an increase in social solidarity in a time of crisis. You'd probably agree with me that we are in a time of crisis now, and that we need an increase in social solidarity, an increase in the sense that we're in it together. I think there is a concern among many people that if you take an action, whether it's in your own case giving up flying or some other action, that all you're doing is making more space for the free riders.
Yes, yeah. That's completely true, of course. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, if I don't fly, then someone else can no doubt do that. Though I think the dynamic market signal is still important in that argument. Yeah, one of the things I think is really important about when we think about some sort of personal carbon approach is that everyone is engaged. It's not saying that the elite can be exempt from this, that all the high emitters have to be involved. It has the same sort of sense of solidarity that we did get with rationing previously. Now, one thing to think about, this word rationing puts a lot of people off, but whatever method we use, whether it's a carbon tax, whether it's a regulation, or whether it's a personal carbon allowance, we have to ration out the scarce resource of how much carbon-based energy we can consume and how much carbon we can put in the atmosphere. That is a scarce resource. So whatever we do, rationing is inevitable. The thing about a carbon allowance card, it brings rationing directly to the fore. It's very clear. It keeps all of us involved. There's a level of fairness and there's a level of clarity to it that I think all of that helps engender wider acceptance and agreements within society than mechanisms whereby we very well know that some of the wealthy people will simply be able to pay that cost and not have to worry about the impacts. And so I think seeing us all in this together, you know, and there's something about that, all in this together, is something that would help engender a wider civil movement towards making significant reductions in our emissions.
And curiously, the whole notion of all in this together, it almost suggests that, if you like, a rowing back from the neoliberal there is no society model, because that's been the dominant economic and social model probably for the last 30 years. And it doesn't appear to have delivered increases in happiness. It certainly delivered increase in consumption, but it doesn't appear to have delivered increases in happiness. It hasn't delivered increases in social solidarity or social well-being that by most measures. So maybe there is something to be said for it.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think certainly what we've seen with the neoliberal model, it has increased absolute levels of consumption well-being.
Yeah.
But the question then for society, I suppose, is firstly, where has that gone? To whom has it gone? And has it increased the sense of well-being of society? And I think there are serious questions to be had about that. And of course, that's not related just to climate change, and not by any means. We've got the Pope coming out and talking about these things. We've got Stiglitz, you know, and Piketty, two very eminent economists coming out and talking about these things. So we see many world's leading thinkers coming out and actually saying the neoliberal model has had its time, and perhaps it should never have been there in the sort of pervasive level that it was. And that's regardless of climate change. I actually think that once you layer climate change on top of a lot of the social problems that have gone alongside this particular model, then I think there's a very clear state to move away from it as rapidly as possible. But in itself, of course, it has failed. I mean, people were better off materially up to 2008, and then if you look at Ireland and look at the UK, generally many of us now are only at that level, if not slightly below that level. So we've not seen, the wealthy have seen very significant increases and ongoing increases in their welfare, the material well-being. You know, the average person and the poor person certainly has not seen those increases.
And also this time, perhaps for the first time, the middle class has also been abandoned.
I think that's true, and it's not just the middle classes in terms of the if you like, the parents today. Mm. It's those parents looking at the prospects for their children, and I think to some extent that's even a bigger issue. Mm. You know, there are parents now looking at their children and think, I will be better off than my children will be. And in our modern sort of contemporary society, in post-industrial society, we have generally expected our children to be better off than we will. Mm. And this is probably the first generation within that society that is anticipating that the children may well not be better, as well off as we are. And again, if we layer climate change on top of that, I think it's very unlikely that the children would be anywhere near as well off as people like I and you have been. Mm.
And that's, we've talked about rationing, we've talked about the neoliberal system. To take a step back, we also have, if you like, a global climate fund now, which is supposed to be contributing or redistributing, if you like, between, at a governmental level, approximately $100 billion a year to help countries mitigate against and prepare for climate change. I gather you're not a fan.
Well, I'm not a fan of two things. First, I don't like, the language you use there, which is the language that's common use about redistribution. Mm. I see this as reparation. We have imposed on other parts of the world huge levels both of damage and of no access to the sorts of things that we have had, i.e. fossil fuels and energy, to overcome those problems and also to see the improved welfare in their society. So we owe them reparation. It is not aid, it is not redistribution, it is what we owe them because of the damage that we have imposed upon their societies and how can we've constrained their ways of resolving the problems that they are facing. So firstly, it's reparation. Second is, what is the sum of money? It is a crumb that's fallen off the table. $100 billion per annum. The subsidy, that's to all the poor parts of the world, both to adapt to climate change that we've imposed upon their societies and to help them reduce their emissions or not follow the same high-carbon energy route and agricultural route that we have chosen to go down in the West. $100 billion per annum. The subsidy to fossil fuels in 2015, according to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, which is not a left-wing think tank or an NGO, it's a very reputable, generally fairly conservative organization, their estimate is that the subsidy to fossil fuels in 2015, the direct and the indirect subsidies, that does include, and the health impacts of things like particulates in the atmosphere and how that affects health and bronchial issues, that the subsidy was $5.3 trillion. So forget the subsidies to renewables, forget the subsidies to nuclear. These are irrelevant relative to the subsidies that the globe has provided to the fossil fuel companies. $5.3 trillion.
So it's 50-fold.
53 times more than we're going to hand the poor parts of the world. Even the UK economy is 30 times more in a single year than the money we're going to give to the poorer parts of the world. And the real sad indictment, to some extent, to me, of this is that not only is it a paltry sum, but then the sort of the clever bit is that we get ourselves to internally argue about, should it be 110, should it be 90, who should pay it? Mm. We're arguing about the size of the crumb. It's not billions, it's trillions that we owe through reparation to the poorer parts of the world. And we can see this, it's not even necessarily altruism, we can see it as self-interest. Mm. That if these parts of the world cannot deal with the climate change that we have imposed upon them, and let's be very clear that we are at an outside chance of a 2°C rise, and that will have devastating consequences for many of the poor parts of the world, but where lots of people live, and in the globalised world we are not insulated from those people anymore, from the impacts of increased food costs, for migration, for military tension. All of those things will play out at home in the UK, in Dublin, across all of Ireland. In a globalised world, we are not going to be able to just think we can close our doors and put up the barriers and think we're protected from climate change.
Yeah, the Syrian conflict, some have described as one of the first climate change wars, if you like. And of course, we've seen a huge migration crisis affecting Europe in ways that we simply never predicted.
Yes. The first thing I would probably say is I would be very cautious about saying it was triggered by climate change. But I do think it is fair to say there's some significant evidence, both in terms of Syria, but also previously in terms of Darfur, where we saw some terrible things happening there, that climate change was an exacerbating issue that was one of the catalysts that drove the sorts of changes that we've seen, the disruption of that society in Syria. I think it would be unreasonable to say climate change was the thing that caused it. But that is the problem with climate change. It's always going to be layered on top of communities that are already stressed anyway. But what we've seen there, again, is indicative of what we'll see elsewhere, when climate change will stress already stressed communities, and we'll see this sort of fragmentation and breakdown of society. And it's a relatively small country, Syria. And I think, just looking at Bangladesh, there are 30 million people who live within 1 metre of sea level rise on the coastal strip of Bangladesh, 30 million. That's half the size of the UK, and your population here in Ireland is, 4.5 million? Mm. So, 30 million people. Now, they are going to be hit by climate change, both by sea level rise, and they already are, of course, been hit by sea level rise, by increased severity of storms and typhoons, and likely by increased frequency of these events as well. that can affect their agricultural systems, it can affect their home, their infrastructure. They are going to be on the move, en masse.
Right. The US military, who, again, not a renowned left-wing organization, they have an interesting phrase they use to describe climate change. They describe it as a threat multiplier. And they see it as being something that exacerbates existing conflicts, existing tensions, existing resource crises. For example, what happened in Cumbria over the last few months, what happened in the Shannon region in Ireland, having a debate about was this one climate change, was it not?
Yeah.
In a climate-changed world, maybe what we really need to say is clearly the dice are being loaded. Would you accept that?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. What we are seeing is a new normal.
Yes.
Any single event could be an extreme weather event. What we see when we see lots of extreme weather events, what we have is a new normal, and that's when we can see the climate signal. The frequency of these events occurring means that we are seeing climate change. Now, there's some evidence to suggest that we're definitely seeing that now, and from the physics, from the basic science and the physics that we understand very well, and also from the modelling that goes alongside that, we expect to see, almost certainly, we're going to see ongoing increases in severity and frequency of these sorts of extreme weather events that are already percolating around the world. But in addition to that, of course, they are, as you say before, they are threat multipliers. Now, for the poorer parts of the world, the more vulnerable parts of the world, they're already stressed anyway. People are struggling to eke out a living or in these communities. This threat multiplier could very quickly catalyse significant, disruption, dislocation, migration, military tensions, and so forth. But as you pointed out, we've already seen that in some of our own communities at home. If you like, we live quite comfortable lives, and then we are suddenly hit by this thing that has a very... The frequency of these things is having a very clear climate signal. We are going to be seeing these things more regularly. And so, therefore, it's not as if it's just a threat multiplier on top of the other things that we face. We live comfortable lives, and then suddenly we're hit by this thing, which is extreme weather. And that extreme weather is causing us huge problems. So even societies that are fairly resilient and robust are really struggling with what we really, when you think about it, we've only seen a 1 degree C temperature rise so far. And this is going to go on and on and on. In the warmest year on record, 2015, if we look since 2000, we have seen year after year after year of the warmest year on record. The carbon dioxide emissions now are higher than they have been for 800,000 years, three times longer than humans are on the planet. The carbon dioxide emissions this year will be 60% higher than they were in 1990. Every single measure that we use shows that we are moving towards a new planet, a different place to live. Unless we make radical changes to our emissions, then we are going to be passing on to our children, to the poor parts of the world, but even to those of us that will be here in 10 or 20 or 30 years, a radically different planet to live on.
We focused, understandably, Kevin, so far on one species. There's a few million other species as well. I thought we should give them a moment or two. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the total number of wild animals in the world has declined by just over 50% in the last 40 years. Now, that suggests that what's been described as the sixth extinction event is already in full flow. Mm. And I wonder, first of all, if you have any thoughts regarding that, considering these are our fellow creatures, both from the point of view of their right to exist in the world with alongside humans, but also, as if you like, as a cautionary tale for what goes around comes around.
Mm. Well, I think, going with the second of those first, the cautionary tale, I think that we, as an academic who doesn't work on this particular area in detail, but I nevertheless think what we can see from this and talk with other colleagues is that this is indicative of the scale of change that we are seeing. And when I say that, it's the rate of change that's important. If these changes occurred across 20 million years, 20,000 years, fine. These changes are occurring within the blink of an eye. I mean, within a handful of generations, we're seeing dramatic changes. Arguably, within a generation, we're seeing significant changes. So I think that what we're seeing globally here, within the sort of, let's call it the natural world, but I mean, really, that's partly the problem, but we have removed ourselves from the natural world when we are really part of it and completely reliant upon it. Without the natural world, we do not exist. So we are seeing these significant changes. All of the people that analyse this have significant concerns. I've not heard anyone that does not think that what we're seeing is very significant, and actually this raises really fundamental concerns for how we as a species are going to survive. Mm. I think seeing ourselves as separate has been part of the problem here. So from a science perspective, I think what we are seeing is as clear a warning as you should ever need, that we need to do something very differently. and very rapidly. But the other part, going back to saying about their right to exist and so forth, I mean, this is a deeply sort of been a felt feeling for me as to why I partly engage in climate change. I mean, it has nothing to do with the science per se, that there's a beauty to our planet, in the way I see this. There's a beauty to our planet, not as a static sort of Victorian view of it that we can pin it out like butterfly wings on a plate and keep it in the museum or whatever it may be, but the dynamics, the beauty of the evolution of our planet. And what we have done, what we have done consciously and knowingly, is we have come in, as I said before, like the meteorite, and we are destroying that process overnight. And we think it's perfectly reasonable to do that, or at least it's not reasonable to not do it. We're not prepared to make the changes to avoid doing that when we have all of the information at our fingertips. So to destroy this place of absolute beauty that we don't know of anywhere else in the universe that is like this. And anyway, even if it did exist, there's still something, you know, much more entwined in being part of this beautiful system, which we are part of it, and we are a wonderful part of it. You know, that we exist as a species is, in a sense, is a splendid outcome of the 3 billion years of evolution that we've had on the planet. And that we have that arrogance now, when we can see all this around us, to think we can destroy not just ourselves, but take the rest of it with us. Mm. I don't mean this in any religious perspective at all, but and perhaps spiritual isn't even necessarily the right word, but there's something there. There's something in that dynamic beauty of our planet that makes me very concerned about issues of climate change, over and above the effects it will have on me, my communities, different parts of the world, and so forth. Over and above that, there's this deeper entrenched love, respect for the place that we live, the place that we have evolved, the place that has nurtured us as a species.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, what you're describing sounds a lot like a moral framing of it, and also perhaps a moral reckoning.
Yes, I think that's a way to see it. But I mean, I almost think though we often use the word amoral or perhaps sometimes immoral, that all of the framings we have some framing of morality in it, but we may question people's different moral frameworks. Mm. But yes, without a doubt, I think we have to be careful here. There isn't a completely neutral approach to anything. Whatever framework we have has some moral dimension to it. So other people might turn around and say it's ridiculous to be talking about this sort of moral framework for these issues. But actually, by saying that, you already have a moral framework and an ethical framework. Mm. Humans have moral and ethical frameworks, and that informs everything we do. It informs how we do our science and our physics. Mm. It informs every facet of our society. So we will never be, and can never be, and perhaps it's a very good thing we can never be like this. We can never be some sort of purely objective, atomized individual. That's not how living species, certainly the human species, has evolved.
To conclude, Kevin, what kind of a world do you see by the middle of this century, knowing what you know about, number one, the science, and number two, human nature and how we do our politics?
I think here it is there's a probability answer here. You know, the chances are that we're going to carry on choosing to fail, and I'm careful about my language there. We are going to choose. We are choosing to fail, and we will likely carry on choosing to fail. We will make the right noises. And sometimes we will make the right noises for the right reasons, but with the wrong reasoning. And I say that word reasoning here because the issue about all of this is time. And actually the scientists have not been particularly helpful here, in that we have allowed this language of a certain emission reduction by 2050, or by 2030, by some period, not in my term of office from a politician's point of view, or we're passing the problem on to the future generations to solve, we hope, with the technology. But actually, climate change isn't about that. It's about this build-up of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere day in, day out. It is a timing issue. So we are choosing to fail. We are choosing to not take notice of our science. And even those of us who work on science are not being vociferous enough about the misuse of our science by policymakers and by wider civil society. So we're all in this sort of collective delusion together, and I include the scientists in this. So if we carry on along those lines, and at the moment, if you were a betting person, which I'm not, I think you'd say that's very likely that we will carry on with sort of rhetoric, the odd tap on the back after a successful COP and a paper agreement that doesn't bring about any action. and we'll carry on like this, and the temperature will keep changing, the world will keep changing. Initially it'll hit poor people, typically non-white, low emitters in the southern hemisphere. Then gradually that will affect food prices, it will affect wars, it will affect access to resources, and then eventually, far too late, we'll come along and think, well, actually, we should have done something about this. What can we do now? And our first response, as we're seeing with the migration issues, is that we'll put up the borders, we'll protect our own well-being, we'll think we're somehow more important than the rest of Europe, or the rest of our colleagues and partners around us. So we will break up and fragment any sense of union which we require, essentially require to address these issues. So that's, for those who have seen the film The Road, that's the road that we are on, and not one that I want to hand to my nieces and my nephews, not one I want to hand to the poor parts of the world, and not one that is in any way appropriate for the beauty of our planet that I was talking about earlier. But it's a probability issue. And there was a word of agency in there. We are likely to choose to fail, but we have an opportunity to choose to succeed. And the reason that people like myself, and I'm sure many of us, work on climate change, I mean, not, some people just love working on climate change, it's interesting work in universities, running models, playing with the maths, looking at the science. But others of us are in there because we like all of that, but we also think it's a worthwhile subject area. Mm. And those of us that think of it like that, we are working this area because we want to instigate change along the lines of what society has told us it wants to deliver, i.e. avoid dangerous climate change, a safe climate within which we can all thrive and prosper, both as our species and other species as well. We are choosing to fail at the moment. We could choose to succeed. We know what we need to do. We have all the wherewithal intellectually, financially, in relation to resources, in terms of renewable energy. We have plenty of that around. We have the intellect and the labour skills to put this stuff in place. We can reduce our energy demand very rapidly without significantly changing the quality of our life, at least for the majority of us. And we can help the poor around the world. We know how to help the poor around the world. We can learn lessons from all around the world in a globalised world. We can see how other people have done things and where they've been successful and where they haven't been successful. We have everything at our fingertips to deliver a low carbon, a zero carbon from an energy perspective, and a very low carbon agricultural system that is in line with a prosperous, thriving society that has its appropriate role as part of this beautiful, dynamic, evolving planet in which we live. All of that is up for grabs. Just at the moment, we are running scared of changing the direction that we're heading, which is the complete polar opposite of that.
This is the urgent conclusion of a one-hour interview with Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. Thanks to the National Trust for Ireland and John Gibbons for posting this moving conversation on YouTube. It is the source of the programme that you just heard. The conversation took place in Dublin in March 2016. The link to the film is on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream.
That's the voice of Dr. Aviva Chomsky. On this week's edition of Latin Waves, we speak to Dr. Chomsky about her book, They Take Our Jobs, and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. Stay tuned.
Dr. Aviva Chomsky has written extensively on the kinds of rights that are denied to many immigrants. In her wonderful book, she dismantles 21 of the most widespread myths and beliefs about immigrants and immigration. Her book is titled They Take Our Jobs. We're very privileged to have Dr. Aviva Chomsky on our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
Now, you've written extensively, not just on the causes of immigration, what causes people to move from a place where they belong, where they are respected and where they have roots, to places where they're invisible. Let's begin there. Let's talk a little bit about the social and economic conditions that drive people from their homelands and most things they care about.
Well, Juan González wrote a great book a couple of years ago called Harvest of Empire. And in his title, he expresses his argument that immigration is the harvest of empire. That is, the conditions that if you look at the global flows of migration in the world today, there's a really clear flow from former colonies into former colonial powers. So you have immigrants coming into the United States from places like Mexico, from Southeast Asia, other parts of the Caribbean, Central America, South America. You see immigrants going into France from Algeria. You see immigrants going into England from India and Pakistan. That the colonial relationship in lots of different ways sets the stage for later migrations. One of the ways it sets the stage is impoverishing the colony and enriching the colonial power. So you see the flow of resources out of the colony into the colonial power, and you see cultural ties set up. And, of course, you see people from the colonial power going into the colony, that is, the British in India or the Americans, U.S. Americans going into Mexico, never stopped to ask for visas. They just invaded and took over. So those ties are set up by, in a sense, the free movement of people. And then the colonial powers clamp down and say, oh, but wait a minute, we can't have that movement going the other way. We're allowed to go everywhere, but they have to stay in these prisons that we created for them.
Immigrants are being used to scapegoat some of the issues the government is having with relation to a downturn economy. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the loss and the criminalization that enables the not only the oppression but the dehumanizing treatment that many of these workers receive?
Yeah, I'm actually working on a new book right now, and I was writing earlier this morning, and I was thinking about the question, what part of illegal don't you understand? And thinking, actually, people don't understand anything about the term illegal, and I'd rather turn back and ask those people, well, what part of illegal do you understand? Like, you really have no idea what you're talking about. You were saying something about naturalizing oppression and naturalizing this category of illegal as if it was something clear-cut and natural that we should divide people up into sort of caste-like categories and label some of them legal and some of them illegal is actually quite a bizarre thing for human beings to do if you really step back and think about it. Clearly, maintaining a portion of the United States population without full civil rights has been true in the United States ever since the United States has come into being. And using that portion of the population that's maintained without full civil rights to do the dirtiest work of society has also been a constant in U.S. history. Today, we use this unnatural concept of illegal to justify keeping a portion of the population in the kind of conditions that's going to force them to do underpaid labor that basically sustains the standard of living of the rest of us. There's certainly nothing just or natural about it. And then on top of that, they get scapegoated. That is, the idea that immigrants are harming the economy then just serves to justify further exploitation of immigrants.
I want to talk a little bit about the myths that allow us to almost make this oppression of people invisible. This, you know, injustice is everywhere, is all around us. And yet it's almost as if you can't see it because it's so inbred and ingrained in our societal norms. So let's talk a little bit about some of the myths. In your book, you titled They Take Our Jobs. Talk about the relationship between this idea that immigrants are actually a burden on the local economy. They're a burden on our countries, and that they take rather than contribute.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's one of the most upside-down myths at all when you actually look at the impact of immigrants on the economy, because immigrants are, in fact, working at the very worst jobs in the economy, using very little in the way of social services and paying far more than their share of taxes. So they're contributing their underpaid labor and they're also contributing their taxes, and they're really getting practically nothing back from the society for what they pay into it because they're not eligible for most social services that citizens are eligible for. The phrase immigrants take American jobs is thrown around so much. It's one of those things almost like if you hear it enough times, it's going to become true. First of all, we live in a global economy, and we've lived in a global economy for many, many years. And if you want to look at some of the different factors that have affected unemployment rates in this country, one of the biggest ones has been the shift of manufacturing abroad. That is, jobs lost in the manufacturing sector because companies have decided that they could make greater profits by evading things like U.S. minimum wage law and environmental protections and health and safety protections in the United States and shifting their production somewhere else. That's one big cause of unemployment. Another big cause of unemployment in the United States is government cutbacks, where people in almost every level of government services, from teachers to social workers, federal, state, and local employees, are losing their jobs because of government cutbacks. Neither of those has anything to do with immigration. And in fact, immigrants tend to fill the job sectors that nobody who has a choice would choose to do. And I'll just give you one example. I'm not sure if this is also the case in California, but certainly in Massachusetts, if you get a daily newspaper delivered, it's very likely delivered by an undocumented immigrant. Newspaper delivery is one of the worst jobs you can practically imagine. You have to get up at 2:30 in the morning and work from 2:30 in the morning till 7:30 in the morning. It's pretty much all done out of your car. You're driving, and it's basically the most difficult manual labor, jumping in and out of your car to put people's newspapers where they want them for 3 or 4 hours every morning. And, of course, it's an expensive job to have because you have to maintain a car and maintain insurance and all of those things. And it's a very, very low-paid job. And on top of that, I don't know if you follow the weather reports on the East Coast, but we've had a series of blizzards this winter that have basically shut down the entire state. And the governor declares a state of emergency and says that everybody should stay in their houses. People should not go out on the street because of the snowplows. Most people's workplaces either close or tell them to come in late or to use their judgment about whether it's safe to be on the road, whether to go into work or not. But the newspaper delivery companies tell their employees that they had better find a way to be there and get all those papers delivered or they're going to lose their roots. This is the kind of job that we're talking about when we say that jobs that Americans don't want are the sectors that immigrants are forced into and can't really protest about their working conditions because of their undocumented status.
I want to also bring another concept that I think has become very popular, and that is the idea of cuts. The common use of the immigrant as the scapegoat for social cuts. They become a burden because they don't pay taxes. They're illegally, so they're not contributing their share. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how this willfulness to create a dual society, both in Canada and the U.S., where you have a large number of people as undocumented and the rest of the population, being able to shift the guilt of government's lack of investment or poor judgment in deregulating banking, reducing taxes for the rich, has created a much larger burden on the middle class, the working class of this country, where that blame is now placed on the most insecure and most vulnerable citizens. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the laws that have gone to not only criminalize the victims of these policies, but also the way in which the society as a whole almost is unable to see them as equals.
Well, in terms of the laws, I think most people really became aware of the legal situation when Arizona passed SB 1070. And a lot of people were outraged at SB 1070, but didn't really realize how much of SB 1070 has already been put into effect through federal law, especially through the 287G program, which trains local police to essentially become enforcers of immigration law. 287G is a voluntary program, but it's a federal program that invites local law enforcement agencies at either the city, county, or state level to collaborate with ICE by going through a training and basically empowering themselves as enforcers of immigration law, which is pretty much what SB 1070 tried to do, and the secure communities, which forces local law enforcement agencies to also become enforcers, essentially become enforcers of immigration law by forcing them to share all information with ICE. That is, it puts ICE everywhere, so that if you're stopped for a traffic violation, your data is going over to ICE. Now, local law enforcement agencies in general have been very opposed to these kinds of laws and programs. They've often been forced into them by mayors and city councils and sheriffs, but the police enforcers on the ground hate these programs because their job is policing the communities that they work in, and they need to maintain good relations with the people in the communities. Their job is protecting the population. And if people are afraid of being turned into immigration, they're going to evade the police, and it ruins the ability of the police to act locally. And yet, 287G has been implemented nationwide, and Secure Communities is in the process of being implemented nationwide. So the legislative situation is actually very grim.
You know, many of these laws also help or create an ability for the average citizen to legitimize the injustice that are committed against immigrants and the oppression and repression that they are victims of.
Underlying a lot of the sort of right-wing populist appeal of these laws is something you mentioned earlier, the idea that, well, immigrants aren't contributing, so we have to save ourselves by punishing immigrants and getting rid of immigrants. And that leads to another one of the myths that I talk about in the book, which is that immigrants don't pay taxes. In fact, the vast majority of immigrants pay taxes. In fact, all immigrants pay taxes of one sort or another, because it's impossible to engage in any economic transaction in this country without paying taxes. You know, paying rent, buying a house, buying gas, buying a car, buying food, any economic transaction is going to be taxed in one way or another. But most immigrants also pay payroll taxes. That is, either by using a TIN, a taxpayer identification number, or by using a false Social Security number, people who are undocumented, most of them, in fact, do pay taxes. They pay into the system, and we see this especially in the case of Social Security, where if you use a false Social Security number, the taxes are deducted from your paycheck, your Social Security and other taxes are deducted, but you have no actual account with Social Security because your name doesn't match the number. So Social Security Administration takes the money, and it's kept in what they call a suspension file, which currently takes in about $7 billion a year from people who are paying into Social Security but are never going to be able to collect because their name doesn't match the Social Security number that they were using. So that $7 billion a year is basically subsidizing the Social Security system for all of the rest of us who have valid Social Security numbers. So that's just one of the ways in which the contribution that immigrants are making is so disproportionate. And yet, the government uses them as an excuse to try to explain the economic suffering that's going on in the middle classes.
In your book, you're very good at pointing out one of the most important myths, and that is in Canada, we call ourselves a multicultural society. In the U.S., the myth is that the United States is a melting pot that has always welcomed immigrants from all over the world. And I wonder if you could talk about the racial discrimination that is part and is so ingrained in the immigration policies, but the most of us fail to see because we've been told that we live in a colorblind society, that you know we welcome everybody. They just have to come to the right roots. Is there a cue for everybody? In my opinion, there seems some people don't have a cue.
You know, it's always seemed kind of ironic to me in the United States how many, many white people say, well, my ancestors came here legally, and as if this is something that they're very proud of. But if you look at the history of U.S. immigration law, the reason their ancestors came here legally is there were no restrictions on white immigration. there were only restrictions on immigration of people of color. And in fact, during the first 100 years of this country's history, the restrictions were not restrictions on immigration, they were restrictions on citizenship of people of color. So as long as there were restrictions on citizenship, where people of color could not be citizens of the United States, there was not only free immigration of people of color, there was forced immigration of people of color through the slave trade. And that was all legal. But it's not necessarily something to be proud of, that the law has always favored people of your race and that your ancestors were able to take advantage of unfair laws that favored people of their race. It's not necessarily something to be ashamed of either. That is, we can't control what the laws were 100 years ago, but we shouldn't go around bragging about the fact that we were able to benefit from unfair advantages, or that our ancestors were. Is there a line? People always say, well, why don't they get in line and wait? Well, the reason they don't get in line and wait is that there is no line. And I think that that's something that people really don't understand. That is, if you come from a European country, there's a line. If you come from Mexico, there's a line for some people, but for most people, there is no line. And that's something that I think people really need to grapple with, that there is no line. People are being forced by U.S. economic policies in Mexico out of their subsistence lives and into the immigrant stream, and then they're told there is no line. The only way you can survive and feed your family is by immigrating, but there's no line to get in to do it.
In your book, you point out that there is a problem with immigration, but it's not the immigrants that are the problem. So what can a society who is intent on creating a more inclusive and a more humane society where we recognize the inherent value of every human life do to make our country's immigration policies reflective of that?
Well, I think there's two things we can do. And one has to do with domestic policies and immigration policies. And I think, you know, both in the United States and Canada, we hold on to this myth that we believe that people should be treated equally and that there shouldn't be discrimination against any group of people. We should make that a reality. That is, we really should treat people equally regardless of immigration status as well as regardless of any other status. And we really shouldn't discriminate against anybody for any reason, including the immigration status. I think we need to change our immigration policies and laws so that they don't discriminate against people who are trying to come into our countries. And on a bigger level, I think we need to look at the kind of global role that countries like the United States and Canada play and how our foreign policies contribute to displacing people and pushing them into the migrant stream. And when I say, is immigration a problem? For most people who are forced to migrate, immigration is a huge problem. They're forced to, as you said at the very beginning, leave their friends and families and communities and to go to a place where they're not welcome, where they may not know anybody, where they're discriminated against. This is a huge problem. Most people who migrate would rather stay home if they could. And it's the global economic system, basically under the control of countries like the United States and Canada, that creates the economic circumstances that force people to migrate.
Thank you so much for being with us. You've written many books. You have an upcoming book as well. Tell us about it.
Yeah. The Cuba book is called A History of the Cuban Revolution, And it came about because I've been teaching the Cuban Revolution for many years and taking students to Cuba while it was still allowed. And one little piece of good news is that it's now allowed again, educational travel to Cuba. Obama did manage to do one good thing in terms of foreign policy and has reopened educational travel to Cuba. But I really haven't found the right book to use in my Cuba classes. I like to use books that are really accessible and that really get into these kinds of myths. And in a way, the immigration book and the concept of the myths was really with me when I was writing the Cuba book, because certainly American students hold a lot of myths about Cuba. So although the book isn't explicitly organized around myths, it's definitely that concept is in there. Mm-hmm. So it's a very brief college-level text on the history of the Cuban Revolution that tries to give an introduction that breaks those myths that so many people in this country have about Cuba.
Thank you so much. Dr. Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history and coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State College. She is the author of several books. And how can people access your books?
Well, the immigration book is published by Beacon Press, so you can get it straight off the Beacon Press website, or you can get it from any online bookseller or have your bookstore, local bookstore, order it. The Cuba book is also published by Wiley Blackwell. And it's available direct from them or from any bookseller.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thanks so much for the chance to talk to you.
Take care.
Before I put on the final song, I want to reiterate that immigrants and other workers become scapegoats for those in power, whose economic policies have failed the majority of people. I discovered a new term this week which explains this behavior. It's called horizontal violence, which is defined as harmful behavior via attitudes, actions, and words and other behaviors that is directed towards us by another colleague. In short, the recession was not caused by the working class or undocumented workers, but the deindustrialization of the country, offshoring of jobs and the destruction of a livable wage, and the speculative trading by bankers and other insiders. Let's focus on the real culprits of this recession. Let's adopt a new term called vertical violence and point our anger where it belongs. Thanks for listening this week. Bye for now.
We're not being taught to deal with the world as it is. We're being taught to deal with this fairyland, which we're not even living in anymore. It's sad, because I'm telling you, and it should not be me telling you.
But whatever he thinks is right, he's from Texas, he's got to be right.
Bueno, y vamos con el tema de esta noche.
The language they speak in Latin America is left, true or false.
Abro mi boca, ojos cerrados y el mundo color boca. Tantas veces me he sentido solo, mano en boca. Mi indigestión, nueva gestión de mi tiempo. Esto es mi testamento, yo me voy, amor, lo siento. Arreglando mi crisis, apocalipsis interior. Mi chiquita, fin del mundo, paso sin temor. Ya se murió mi mala suerte, mi nube negra. Pon una nube de leche en mi café, nena. Azúcar también, palabras cruzan también. Por eso duermo bien si por lo menos toco a alguien. Imbécil, mi tesis es la historia de un cambio de energía que me trae gloria. Sigue mi filosofía hasta que me muera. Mi lucha es brillarte como un baile de capoeira. Fuera del tema de la vida no queda nada. Pana mata el miedo y quédate firme como zapata. Al ritmo del palo y de la lata el sol aparece. Alquimia personal no es nada fatal. Por eso te lo digo, arriba este instrumental. No vale más
injustice. The blood in the streets, our rights, our homes, the property the lease. I know we gon' get it again. I know we gon' find the end. Injustice, keep the blood in the streets, our rights, our homes, the property the lease. I know we gon' get it again.
My voice that resonates, my rib cage is filled with magnetic fuel. 12 jewels, goose to serve fools. Reach like a telephone. Weeks have been alone in China. Back in my zone, so I can write this few songs. The school of life is my home. I'm roaming like a home. A bump is sickening stuff, supporting beer bottle. It seems like the dust can never settle in the street. Riches always in need, just like a mouth to feed. A melted pot for weeks of get along. Acting fake like silicone. All the layers defective, it's time to say a prayer. Don't count on your mayor. It's all human behavior. The words are planted, that we can make a difference. My appeals, schizophrenic, I'm big switching like split personality. My alter ego, to satisfy my need for change. We form from a worm, form the butterfly. We need no alibi to justify this crime.
Injustice, keep kids are flooding the streets and that's our homes and prophecy to leave.
Des questions pas posées. Combien dirige à ton cerveau paralysé, brisé, couillon, esquelette, pile vérissée. Quelle est notre première utilité, nos têtes qui poisent. Pitié, gâte tout bien haut pour qu'arriver. Nos mondes réussis, son projet réalisé. Nos bêtes moins son tête de plus en vérité, son bénéfice. Souffle les sorties sous l'ombre et son fond sacrifice. Fils, mes vieilles archivistes, cache tout chimiste. Yo, putain, j'ai passé n'importe quel virus. Ta vie m'active, faut voir, j'y positif, veillatif. Et tes proches et accompagnons qui construit nos besoins chef pour créatif, même j'avais le grève, chant, en vie, paye ou bien, mais fais tout ce qu'on est pour pas quitter le traîner. Ton courage fait mon pas pour meilleur en fait.
Just this, keep the blood in the streets, and that's our homes, the prophecy leaks.
Fue el que empezó a atacar verbalmente a todos los periodistas, a los camarógrafos, y fue el que dio inicio a la trifulca.
That was the incredible lyrics and music of Pneumatic Massive and their song title, Say the Least. For information on their music, you can go to pneumaticmassive.org. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.